Yeah, we're live. We're live. Okay. I don't know why Caesar said that's painfully bad. That is the Kosovo national anthem, the national anthem of the Republic of Kosovo. As you know, they're a republic now.
Yeah. And Caesar, those are some of our biggest fans.
Some of our biggest fans in Kosovo. I do want to thank all our fans in Kosovo. As I've been getting emails and Facebook. People have been adding me on Facebook from Kosovo, chatting me up all week.
Yeah, we love it. Very much appreciated.
Thank you, guys.
Very appreciative of it. And just put that bronze statue of me right next to Bill Clinton, right next to him. We are the kings of the blowjobs.
I did not have sexual
relations. So, in all seriousness, no. You know, God bless the people of Kosovo for being fans.
Yeah, yes. Their money's as green as ours, as you said, Mikey. So we will go. We will one day go to Kosovo, and
you never know if it gets popular enough.
Start stocking
the president of Kosovo might call you and be like, hey.
Boy,
come on out. You do a remote broadcast from
Kosovo. A remote broadcast from Kosovo. Yeah.
Start stocking up on food now, Kosovo.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of food they got. He said to me, he goes, I know you like apple pie. We have good apple pie because, you know, we're American.
Yeah, right. You know, man, as American as apple pie. I do. I mean, I love it.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the apple pie.
Ironically, though, apple pie was probably first, if it was first made here in the United States, it was probably made by European immigrants.
The apple pie?
The Dutch probably actually were the first people to do the apple pie.
I kind of believe you on that, like the Dutch pancakes.
Dutch apple pie.
Actually, you ever had the large German pancake with a little bit of lemon
mm-hmm.
wedge and powdered
mm-hmm.
sugar?
Very the ones that take 45 minutes?
They're very tasty.
Yeah, I know they are.
Although sometimes the Mexican cooks are these.
You ever read those menus, though? They're like, it will take 45 minutes
always,
for your...
Always. And here's the amazing thing. You're at a breakfast restaurant owned by Greeks with Mexican cooks making a German pancake.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of chance for error sometimes.
Well, I heard Omega shut down. Rafe and Anthony came by, and they told me they don't have running water, and they shut down 2 days ago.
The one in Ogden?
Yes, but supposedly, allegedly, they got $1 million loan from somebody, so they'll be back up soon.
Yeah, the dad.
No, they got $1 million loan.
Were they hurting for
business? It ain't from no dad. Huh?
They usually are packed.
I don't know. You and I ate there 2 weeks ago. I was really afraid Rafe and Anthony were going to tell me the chicken salad was contaminated. they found out it was sitting there for a month.
No, I'm
gambling.
I'm just throwing this out here. I'm just saying, like, I'm just wondering if it's an issue of a lack of business. I mean, why would your water get shut off?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, sometimes, I'm not saying this is Omega.
Allegedly.
I'm not saying this is Omega, but sometimes you have kids in your life. And those kids sometimes spend all your fucking money.
Hmm.
And then sometimes you owe people a lot of money and you can't pay the bills. That is probably not Omega, mind you. I'm just saying that's a possibility.
No. And then sometimes you get some threatening phone calls.
Right there. That's what it was right there. My phone went off.
And sometimes you want to move the whole family back to Greece.
So, by the way, did you hear who's on the show today?
Yeah, Matthew Lillard.
Matthew Lillard and Allison Burnett.
Yep.
Allison Burnett, who wrote Gone with Amanda Seyfried, Resurrecting the Champ with Sam Jackson and Josh Hartnett, Feast of Love with Morgan Freeman and Greg Kinnear. He's joining us. And Matthew Lillard. And
Matthew Lillard, 13 Ghosts, right?
13 Ghosts.
Yeah.
All right.
Great.
Scooby-Doo.
Yep.
He's the new Shaggy. He even does the cartoons.
You know, it's a good Shaggy, too.
I got to say, I love Casey Kasem, but he may be a little better than Casey Kasem.
Wow.
He might be.
And what's funny is, I thought Matt Lillard would be a big pothead. I don't think he is now. I think he may have been in the SLC punk day.
Or the hacker days, for that matter.
Or the hacker days.
I'm like, wait
or the
a
hacker days, Mad Love. Mad Love, anybody?
Yeah.
With Chris O'Donnell and Drew Barrymore. I know that's on Adam's favorites.
What's the more movie?
It's in your queue.
There's a movie I remember seeing Matt Lillard in, and I can't think of the name of it.
Scream?
There we go.
Okay.
Yep.
She's All That with Freddie Prinze.
Yep.
Summer
She's
Catch.
She's All That. I forgot
Summer
about
Catch
that.
With Freddie Prinze.
Yep.
Him and Freddie Prinze did four movies together.
Oh, you know what? I remember Summer Catch. Summer Catch is when they were in the baseball league.
Yeah.
And I remember. I loved the movie because they talked about Frank Thomas in the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And then Matt Lillard had a scene in the movie where he was just bitching up a storm because he couldn't figure out his hit with a wooden bat.
I knew someone saw Summer catch.
Oh, yeah.
There it is.
Man, I'm a baseball player. You know? So, I mean, I was like, oh, a movie about baseball?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, they did 4 movies together. Isn't that kind of weird? They're like Martin and Sinatra, those two.
Well,
Freddie Prinze and Matt Lillard.
Well, that,
hang on a minute.
Yeah, but what's this... trying to remember some of the cast from American Pie and American Reunion, although some of those guys, Stifler, made a bunch of movies with the same people too.
Well, they all made those 4 movies together, but these guys did different movies.
I'm talking
together.
About different movies. I found that happens. Like the guy who's the name of the famous writer that did 40-Year-Old Virgin and all
Judd Apatow. Yeah, they all make movies.
Yeah, you notice that every Apatow movie has the same people in it.
Well, I do want to say Matt Lillard's new movie, Fat Kid Rules the World, which he directed, he's not in. We love fat kids here, ruling the world.
So far, I'm really enjoying this. The geeks have had their day. The geeks have run the world. Now it's time for fat people to run the world.
Take it easy.
And I will say the kid that's in this movie, Jacob Wysocki, and there's a lot of great talent in this movie. But Jacob Wysocki's in a movie called Terry, which you would love, Adam. Terry with John C. Reilly and Jacob Wysocki. You have to see Terry. Terry is an excellent, excellent movie. And fat kids do rule the world, by the way. But Matthew will talk about it. And Allison Burnett just came on to shoot some shit with me. And if you're a writer or you want to be a writer, you want to listen to this interview. It is basically the hard knocks of what you have to do as a writer to make it, what you have to deal with as a writer, and how happy you're going to be as a writer. I'm sure we'll factor into it all. I do want to thank our friends in Kosovo, though. That's great. I'm still just blown away by Kosovo.
No, actually, I think that's awesome. This is a great. This is.
We've had foreign listeners. We had Australia. We had Italy. Kosovo.
This is a perfect.
New Zealand.
This is a perfect example of how the medium of the internet is just really just eliminates the barriers of distance.
Well, this is why it's better than being on terrestrial radio.
Absolutely.
Okay, so everyone in Chicago knows us, but no one knows us in Kosovo.
But we know they know us in Kosovo now.
That's right.
Do you know what language they speak in Kosovo? Is it like Kosovanian?
Probably Kosovan.
No, I'm kidding.
It's right next to the Czech Republic.
Kosovo's right next to the Czech Republic?
Yes.
I always pictured Kosovo of less as an Eastern European country, more of like a Middle Eastern country.
I'm sorry about that. But guys,
I don't know. I don't know. We're going to have to go there and check it out. They want us to come there, though. They did say there will be women for us.
Well, I think the Czech...
Slavic language?
The Czech... if it's Slavic... I know the Austrians speak German. Obviously, Germans speak German. I'm sure they have to. It must be. It's probably the same. They might speak Czech over there.
Pat wanted me to correct myself. Matthew Lillard does have a small role in Fat Kid Rules the World.
So. Okay.
He is in it. But,
oh, that's good.
But he directed it. This is his baby.
Did I tell you I saw The Dark Knight Rises?
And without spoiling it, because I still haven't seen it. I heard my predictions were pretty close to Dead On.
There was a joke that I – well, no, I don't want to ruin the movie. But there was a joke that I made to you that was completely out of left field, and I thought I was just trying to be funny. And it turned out to be true. And I was shitting my pants in the theater. I was like, you got to be shitting me. I fucking called this. And like, you got – it was a bad scene for the people sitting next to me, but.
I like when you get loud in movie theaters. So I think we'll play this Allison Burnett interview right now.
Oh, great.
So sit down, pour yourself a glass of your finest brandy, open up a box of your famous Panda Express.
I'm going to finish my rice now.
I think Panda Express is gross.
Speaking of Allison's, I'd like to have Allison Rosati on the show someday.
Rosati pizza?
I would love to have some Rosatis right now.
No, Allison Rosati. You think Allison Rosati's husband owns... Rosati.
I did a sketch for Steve Weirich, where I played a Rosati's pizza delivery man.
But didn't you do like pizza?
And one of the improv lines I had was some guy was going to beat me up or whatever, and I said, I'm going to call my sister Allison, and we're going to get on the news. And I said, you're fucked, pal.
It's on YouTube, people. You guys can
watch it. It is on YouTube. Yeah. If you want to sit through the godfather of short films, because I think it's like 30 minutes.
I did watch a movie the other day with... It was a special on the anniversary of Godfather. It was on the History Channel. It was very good. I just want to throw this out here. There was a very low budget short film that was done, and it was Batman versus Alien versus Predator.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
I never seen it. Ain't good?
It was pretty good.
Was it good?
Yeah.
Wait, what's the story behind it? Talk. Let Adam have the microphone. I want to hear this. It's supposed to be outstanding.
Supposedly a guy that worked on the studio lot
was
staying after everything shut down and filming his own movie in secret with the costumes from all the movies.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. It's awesome.
All right, I got to see this.
No, it's
that was Adam Bennett.
There's a reason I brought it up.
By the way, Alex Luis, he's sitting in. He's eating panda, though.
What's going on, guys?
And Mikey Turzo.
You know, pandas are endangered.
Mikey Turzo.
Eating a panda.
And Mikey Turzo and I, we were complaining before the show about how Panda Express ain't that good.
No, the egg rolls are terrible.
Yeah, you think you would knock out the egg roll if you were going to do Asian fast food.
Here's where they got you.
That'd be a home run.
Here's where they got you. I knew that egg roll was terrible, but I still ate it.
Well, yeah, of course you ate it because you wanted the sweet and sour sauce more than the egg roll.
No, in my mind, I have hope that the next bite will maybe taste like
have a little more shrimp, a little more pork.
I don't know.
No, shrimp. There's no shrimp.
I'll tell you what I could go for, though. You know what happened to me one time? I got intoxicated.
No, they have that shrimp there. They have a shrimp there.
No, it's a veggie.
No, they have a shrimp dish at Panda Express.
No, we're talking shrimp egg rolls.
Shrimp egg rolls anymore.
I'm just going to
chicken and vegetables. That's it.
Warn all you guys now.
At Panda?
Yep, that's it.
It sucks.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm going to warn you guys right now. All the times I've eaten egg rolls. I finally lived a dream one time that I had from when I was a kid. And I had a couple drinks in me. And I went to one of my favorite Chinese restaurants. And I have a very indifferent show for Chinese restaurants. Some I go to if I want orange chicken. Some I go to if I want sweet and sour chicken. Some I go to specifically for the egg rolls because they all have their strengths and weaknesses. So I got a couple of drunk, and I said, you know what? I'm fucking living this dream.
You're going to all three?
And I went to the Chinese restaurant that I prefer for egg rolls, and I got 12 orders of egg rolls. And she goes,
not two each, though, right? Just 12.
No, two each.
24
egg
rolls?
Yeah. So she comes over, and she goes, excuse me, you want... You want that 12 egg roll, or you want 24 egg roll? I go, well, doesn't it come in orders of two? She goes, yeah. I go, well, then I want 24 egg rolls. She goes, oh, okay, maybe right back. And she, like, comes back, and they bring this mound of egg rolls. And they had it all, like, origami, like, piled into, like, a little, like, pyramid.
Did they have sparklers on top
real good
of
with
it?
That. No. And then she brings you a bowl.
They dressed up your egg rolls for you.
And they brought a bowl of sweet and sour sauce.
Like a bowl.
And that's one of the reasons they picked this place, because they make their own sweet and sour. I think it's got a touch of applesauce in it. It's very good. I'll make this quick, but...
No, it's okay. I'm interested.
And so I started
Allison
going to
Burnett can wait. We want to hear about 24
and
egg
I'm
rolls.
I'm going to town, and I'm by myself. Like, I don't want anybody talking to me. I don't want phone calls. I am focused on one thing, and that is egg rolls and sweet and sour sauce. And I start going, I've piled down for about 15 or 16 of these things. I'm starting to feel terrible. I don't know if it's the grease, the sweet and sour, the alcohol that I drink. I don't know, but I might have pushed down. Like, I end up just feeling so terrible. I pass out on the bench that I'm at. I wake up like 2.5 hours later. There's fucking sweet and sour sauce all over the table. There's crumbs of egg rolls all over. I mean, it looks like it was terrible. It's disgusting. I wake up, and there's this little Asian lady that must have been, like, 85 years old that I hadn't seen. She goes,
just staring at you.
She looks at me. She's poking me. She's not even saying anything. Like, she doesn't even know how to speak broken English.
Godzilla?
So she's Godzilla? Godzilla? Poking me. And I wake up, and I look at her, and she just goes, and she just, like, waddles off in her little geisha dress.
All right, well, Allison Burnett is, for all of you that have stuck around for that, who enjoyed Mikey's, if you did,
I'm just saying,
if you answered for Mikey's 24 egg rolls.
I know egg rolls are good, but limit yourself at 8.
Yeah, he had the egg roll sweats, he passed out, he went into an egg roll coma.
Oh, man.
All right, but this is Allison Burnett, he, of course, of Gone and Resurrecting the Champ in Autumn in New York and Feast of Love. Please give this interview a listen, and then we'll be back, and then we have Matthew Lillard. We may be going into overtime tonight for sure, just so you know, but here is Allison Burnett.
All right, in the off-time.
It's Matthew Lillard, and I'm here with Allison Burnett. You, of course, are a very famous writer, and you're from Illinois, which is a big thing for me. But
I lived in Evanston from the time I was 10 years old until I finished college.
Yeah, and just so people know, go to allisonburnett.com and you'll get the whole resume. But, I mean, you wrote Gone. You wrote Underworld Awakening. You wrote the remake of Fame, Resurrecting the Champ with Sam Jackson. Rod Lurie directed it, a buddy of mine. Trey Stoll. I mean, just Autumn in New York. Just some really good films. And then, of course, you've done some novels. And, of course, what I want to get into also is your criticisms as well. But The Death by Sunshine's a novel. Yours, Undiscovered Girl. The House is Beautiful. So let's talk about a bunch of things here. Because as a writer, I'm very curious about it. I can talk to you all day, probably. So my first question for you is, when did you know you were going to be a writer? Where was it? What was the moment like? When did you know?
I had all written when I was a kid, just always writing things. And I got to Northwestern where I thought that I would probably do some comedy writing, maybe sketch writing, and still continue acting, because I was acting at that point.
Yeah.
And I finished Northwestern in 3 years. I went through pretty quickly. I acted in a lot of shows. And if you were someone at NU who was in a lot of shows and got lead roles, you were probably going to have a pretty good career. That was pretty much expected. And so I kind of thought that I could have an acting career.
Yeah.
But I won the playwright contest my senior year. And I started to think more about the kind of life I would have as a writer as opposed to as an actor. And I also wanted to be really good at something. And I knew that I had speech and movement and voice limitations as an actor that were really going to prevent me from operating at a really, really high level, certainly as a stage actor. And I thought writing came very much more easily. And then I went to New York. I auditioned for a play. I moved to New York City right after college. And I auditioned for a play, and I got the lead role, and it was just a really dismal experience. And I just knew in the midst of that dismal experience that I'd had enough and I'd reached my breaking point. And I made a commitment. I was probably just turned 21, and I made a commitment to myself that was it. I was just going to be a writer, and I never acted again. And that was it. I committed fully at 21.
Was that scary for you to be a writer, to decide you were going to be a writer? Because what I go through, and I'm the same way as you, I want to act, but I also write because I just feel like when I write, I feel like I'm writing because no one else is writing what I'm writing. Like, I feel like I need to write it, not necessarily that I want to. I feel like I need to.
That's interesting. Yeah. I always felt like time passed really quickly when I was writing.
Yeah.
And that I had a facility for it, and that I liked that feeling of hours going by. And also, I was obsessed with great literature, and I was reading great literature in college and afterward. And so the people that wrote novels and the people that wrote poetry seemed to me, and plays, seemed to me my heroes.
Right.
And I knew that I just had I did have a need to write, but I didn't necessarily feel or know that what I was writing, that if I didn't do it, no one else would.
Yeah.
Certainly, I didn't feel that way in my 20s. I wrote plays in my 20s. Then I wrote fiction. I wrote some novels that nobody read and nobody gave. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have any idea how to connect my literary idealism to the reality of a marketplace. They didn't train you in that at Northwestern.
No,
I never thought about my audience when I began writing something. I was really in a bubble. And I did that for 10 years. And I had to work 40 hours a week to survive. I was a proofreader at a law firm. I was a T tutor. It was grueling because I was writing a lot of hours and working a lot of hours to make money. And then at the end of the decade, still very confident in my talent, but absolutely wretchedly self-loathing in terms of my inability to monetize that talent.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I just had no idea what the hell I was doing in terms of writing something that anybody would pay for and how to be a professional. I met a guy who had been in jail for bank robbery, and he was bouncing at a club, and he really wanted to write. And I knew the day I met him that if I co-wrote with him and I worked with him writing screenplays, that I would have a career. I was absolutely positive.
Did that happen?
And I just knew it. I knew he would remove me from the part of writing that was self-therapeutic. You know, I think a lot of writers in their 20s, an old adage that, you know, young writers are masturbating in front of the mirror. There is an element of that where you're kind of trapped up in your own solipsistic psychological junk, and you're kind of groping in all of that, and that writing is somehow you're venting some of your childhood angst and anxiety and neuroses. And I knew this guy, being a bank robber, would get me out of all of that and get me into the world. And so we wrote a couple of screenplays. He came out here alone, and we sold one of them to the king of schlock, Roger Corman. And it wasn't a schlocky script. It was actually a really serious script.
Wow.
And that was my introduction to Hollywood. I just said, enough's enough. I'm tired of being broke. And I sold most of my stuff, and I jumped on a train, actually, and came to Los Angeles. And it was scary, but I just knew I'd have a career, and I was right.
So what let me stop right there. I'm going to get back to this, but I want to hear about Roger Corman. What's that experience like? When did you get to meet Roger? And
yes.
And so the whole—
Yes, I did. It was a joke, honestly. I'm not one of those that can hold him in such high regard.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting that he's— what does he say? He's made 1,000 movies and never lost money. But, you know, he's done that because he's exploited, you know, everybody that comes to town by paying them slave wages.
Yeah.
And, you know, we arrived, we'd written this very serious drama about race relations in prison. And the movie hinged on the hero being white and being caught between a white supremacist gang and a black gang. And it was like a very serious movie. And our very first day, you know, we're in L.A., we go into his office, and he tells us that the hero of our movie is going to be a Japanese-American kickboxer, and that our movie is going to be part of a series and is going to be called Blood Fist 3, Forced to Fight. And, I mean, I was just gobsmacked. I could not believe the audacity, and that he didn't tell us this before he gave us a whopping $12,000 for our script.
Yeah.
so we do some rewrites for him. He tells us to keep the hero's dialogue to a minimum because the lead guy can't act. And then we come back a few months later because we're ready to shoot your movie, but we need you to cut, you know, 2/3 of the locations and 2/3 of the speaking roles, and we'll give you $1,000 each to do it. And it was just beyond depressing. You know, they made into, you know, probably the very best bad kickboxing movie ever made. And then they called us in and said, do you want $3,000 each to rewrite your movie again and set it in a female Mexican prison? Like, they were going to pay us, basically, they were going to make another— they ended up making two more versions of our movie, one in Bangkok and one in Mexico.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, we said no, by the way. We had just eaten enough shit, we just couldn't take it. And so that was it. So I don't have great feelings about that. All I can say is, by his misinforming us and not letting us know he intended to eviscerate our script, it did get me to move out here. And that was enough to kickstart my career. So I guess for that, I'm grateful.
Yes. And, you know, I think that's very interesting. I think that's actually— in a way, I think it's great that you're actually very honest about your feelings about Roger Corman. And I feel like everyone, because there's a lot of film fans out there that actually go into the business. And I think everyone's like, oh, wow, this guy did it with nothing. And everyone's so happy for him. I think a lot of people forget the way he did it with nothing was he ripped people off, like, real bad.
But yeah, well, first of all, it's all non-union. So, you know, there's no protections for anything. He never gives you residuals, or you don't get anything. He can run your movie till the end of time, and you get nothing. You have no protection in terms of anything because there's no guild. And second of all, you know, even when he auditioned, like, we had some good actors audition, people that really made an interesting movie. He gave a little money to Richard Roundtree, who did actually a really great job in the movie.
Yeah.
And then everyone else, he got his third and fourth choices because the first through third choices would not do the movie for the absurd amount of money he was paying the actors. So we had all the fourth string actors. You know, it's, you know, he's done it over and over again. So, I mean, you know, if you get a kick out of it, this movie, great. I don't judge him for that. I just don't. You know, it reminds me of a story. I don't know if this story is true, but I always loved it. If it isn't, it should be. Is that when Coppola was in trouble on Apocalypse Now, he called George Lucas and asked for, you know, a $2 million or $3 million loan, you know, to get through it, his movie, and Lucas said no. And Coppola said, "How can you do that? I was the first person to give you a break." And he said, "You were the first person to step forward and exploit me, and I'm supposed to be grateful."
Oh, wow.
Because the fact is, no one does you any favors. They only do it because they think they're going to make a shitload of money off you.
Yeah.
And that they're going to get you for nothing. You know, that's why you get breaks. And it's not like they're bad people. It's just business. But to then turn around and expect you to be somehow, you know, eternally grateful for the fact that they saw an opportunity to make money, you know, is a little weird.
Well, let me then ask you about this, because your second film is directed by one of my favorite actors ever, and that's Gregory Hines. Was it a different experience with Gregory? And would you say, in hindsight, that you maybe owe more to someone like Gregory Hines than Roger Corman, even though Roger Corman did your first film?
You know, I owe more to the guy who made that movie, and it wasn't Gregory. It was a guy named Mark Jacobs, who, no relation to the fashion designer, and he put $1 million. He said to me, "If you write a movie about race relations, I'll make the movie." And it was for him to star in. So he put $1 million of his own money up, and that inspired me to write the script. And then another guy came in with another $1 million, and I was very grateful for that movie because it gave me a chance to be on a set every day in New York City, see how movies are made. And quite frankly, Gregory Hines did so little on that film that it still was presentable, that it made me realize I could direct myself. And that was the biggest lesson I learned. I learned how movies are put together, and I realized I could direct, and that I didn't need to be afraid of it. Because Gregory was a lovely guy, but he was, you know, he just wasn't driven.
Yeah.
He had the laid-back manner of a 1970s stoner. He was very passive. And the DP did a lot of the film, the directing of the camera, and a lot of the actors were sort of left to their own devices. And the really good actors shone, and the actors that weren't so great didn't. And so as much as I liked him personally, he didn't do, I thought, a very good job on the movie. But actually, it inspired me, because I realized, my God, if he can do so little and the movie still looks like a movie, I would be an absolute maniac compared to him in terms of my involvement and how much I care about details. So I ended up directing a movie called Red Meat,
right,
about 4 years later. And I think I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't seen Gregory.
Right, and you did Red Meat with Jennifer Grey and Laura Flynn Boyle. And
ironically, one of the things that held back the movie from getting a really good release was that we didn't have a male lead that was marketable. And it's ironic because the male lead is John Slattery from Mad Men, who is a beloved actor now. And this was like his first big lead film role, and he's absolutely great in it. I really recommend to your cinephile listeners, if they hadn't seen Red Meat, to go get it for Netflix, because Slattery's incredible. Lara Flynn Boyle, I don't think, was ever better. A wonderful English actor whom they may recognize, named James Frain, is in it, who's also really terrific. And it's a very subversive kind of, I think, if I may speak immodestly, I think it's a very subversive, and I think it's a really good movie. And a lot, and some people that rent it think they're renting some softcore porn film because it's called Red Meat.
Right.
But in fact, it's a pretty serious movie about misogyny. And what starts off as a kind of buddy flick of guys being profane and joking about sex, and it creeps up on you and becomes, by the end, a much more serious movie than they ever bargained for. So I think it holds up pretty well. We made it for no money in 18 days.
Well, I hope they hold that movie at Cinephile over on Santa Monica Boulevard. I'm going to have to ask Dean Fernando if they don't got it, get it.
I hope they do.
Yeah, well, Cinephile.
I don't know if they have it anymore.
Cinephile's got. Have you been to Cinephile on Santa Monica?
Yes, I used to be. Yeah, I used to be a In the pre-Netflix days, I was over there a lot.
Yeah, I don't use Netflix anymore. I actually switched from Netflix to them. It was I don't know. I just love the place, and I love actually going out and getting a movie still. And
well, I love that you love that. And if film were my only preoccupation, I think I'd probably be more like you. But
you're too busy.
You know, I have two kids under seven. I have a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Oh wow!
And I have I read a lot, but so much reading to do for work, so many books and screenplays that I have to read for work, that it's like I just can't devote myself with that single-minded purpose of a true cinephile, you know?
Yeah.
And I've been watching tons of movies made in the 40s. I get almost every noir I want.
I love those.
From Netflix or from a guy I know that sort of tapes them off TV. So I never really go to that extra level, but I really respect, and it's like I really admire people who still buy vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish I could be one of those people, but life's too short. You know, there's only so much you can be obsessed with.
No, I understand. I'm a single 28-year-old male. I can go to the video store still.
Have you seen Red Meat yet?
I have not seen it, and that's what I was going to tell you is I wanted to see it.
I'd love you to see it. I'd be really interested to what a 28. I get letters every now and then. It's usually from cinephiles in their 20s, guys.
Yeah.
Because it's really like it's a sophisticated movie in a way that you don't expect. You think it's just going to be like, you know, a bunch of guys telling filthy jokes and there's nudity in it. But it becomes, so a lot of the kids, Netflix, you know, it gets bad ratings from some young people because they're pissed off because they think what they're going to watch, like a lighthearted, you know, kiddie movie, and then they're kind of bummed out that it's this other thing. But I'd really be curious to hear what you think. So I hope you'll drop me an email.
I absolutely will. I can't wait.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot about this because I'm about to. What happened is I directed that movie in 97. It came out in 98. And it was the first world premiere on the Science Channel. And I never directed again. I didn't even get close to directing again because I wrote Autumn in New York.
Yeah.
Got made. It sort of put me back into the studio world of screenwriting. And then I began writing novels. And I really believe in order to be a happy screenwriter, of which I am definitely one, you have to have some other thing that that fulfills you.
Yeah.
If your only sense of self-esteem and kind of authorial dignity comes from being a screenwriter, you're going to go out of your mind. You're going to become bitter, depressed. You'll speak irrationally and angrily at parties in ways that you shouldn't. Your girlfriend will hate you because no matter what you do, it's unavoidable. You will be disappointed. You will be degraded. You will be disrespected, really, really unfairly too. Like just so many. You have to imagine that like you're a chef and you come up with recipes for a soup, and then you go into a kitchen and there's 10 different cooks cooking it. And they all have more power than you do. And one says, you know what? It tastes great. It looks great. But I'm going to make one little improvement. I'm going to take out the salt. And you go, no, no, you can't take out the salt. It's really important. They go, come on. It's 2 ounces. It's two, you know, it's 2 ounces. What are you talking about? It's nothing. And they take it out. And the soup tastes like shit. And everyone goes, wow, what a bad recipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's like. And I can put up with all those indignities, and I don't even get all that mad or depressed because I know that I have these novels I write that no one touches, that are all mine, that say just what I want. And I know I have Red Meat that was that way. I mean, every cut, everything about Red Meat was the way I wanted, except for probably about, you know, 100 frames of film. I mean, really, it was I had so much control. Anyway, I'm about to direct it again now because the book world has become pretty overcrowded with the advent of ebooks, and it's starting to become demoralizing. And so I'm going to go back and direct an indie based on one of my novels. So I'm excited. I'm going to start directing on October 2nd. It's going to be Undiscovered Girl.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of my books that did the best. It's narrated by a 17-year-old female blogger. So I'm thinking a lot about Red Meat these days and about that experience. And maybe, who knows, maybe this will be a chapter where I'll go back to directing.
So with Undiscovered Girl, is it going to be completely indie? Is it going to be? Are you going to be looking for new people to be in it?
Completely. It's $500,000 of independent equity. We might have stars in it. I mean, we'd like to. It helps you get distribution. But we will, you know, but it's going to be done on a shoe. I mean, that's pretty much a shoestring for this movie because
right.
this is not a little tiny. I mean, Red Meat was made for the same amount, and Red Meat was a tiny movie compared to this. This has more locations, and it's going to be tough, but we're going to do it. And if we might raise more money, depending on the cast, we'll see.
I think that's excellent that you're going back to directing. I was talking about this with a writer friend of mine yesterday, and we were talking about how, you know, he really likes his director friends, and he really respects what they do, but every time he's on set, he just gets this feeling that, like, he wants to do it. And then he's going to start directing, and I told him that's great. And do you ever feel that way when you're on the set of a film? Like, do you ever
I'm hardly
feel like,
ever. I know yeah. that this is so funny, but I'm hardly ever on the set of a film.
Yeah.
Which I think is a testament to the fact that I want to be directing. Because, you know, almost without exception, I have felt that the directors who worked on my stuff did not elevate it and did not make it better. And sometimes, you know, it is. There are exceptions to that. Who directors who I thought did a great job, but most don't. You know, Oliver Stone always said the only reason he became a director was so that his movies would be good,
right.
because he was tired of watching other people screw them up. And so if you have that belief in yourself, maybe it's arrogance, maybe it's delusional, who knows, but if you believe that you can make it better and you can do it well, being on a set is entirely unpleasant.
Right.
You know, and so I never asked to be on the set. And I work a lot for a company that doesn't really care if I'm there or not. You know, if they need a line rewritten or they need me to think of something, you know, in the electronic age, it's very easy for me to do it from home. And so I never asked to be. I didn't even visit the set of Fame, and it was shot, you know, 3 miles from here.
Well, Allison, what I was going to ask you is, we were talking about if money doesn't matter, if money's not an object. I mean, isn't really then, I mean, let's just be honest, the most important thing when you write something is then for you to appreciate what it turns into. So, for instance, like you getting to direct, if money's not, doesn't matter, if it doesn't matter if a billion people see the movie, if it's a huge hit in your mind, don't you just want to see the product you want to see?
Yes, and that's exactly why I've been writing novels.
Yeah.
Because if you took my four novels that have been published, and you took the amount of money I made from all of them, I have, and let's just say conservatively, the four books took 4 years to write, although they did take longer. But it was probably, let's say, 5 or 6 years. All the money I've made from all those books, I have made in 3 days of screenwriting.
Oh, wow.
So I don't do it for the money, but I know that that book is exactly the way I want it, and that there's nothing in between me and the reader, and that's an incredible feeling. I love it. Like, I was just on an Amtrak train. I just got off a 2-day train from Chicago to Los Angeles because I was on vacation with my family in Michigan. And my 6-year-old and I took the train back. And I met this lovely couple of women, sisters in their 60s, and they love to read. So they ordered one of my books on Kindle while we were on the train, and she read it out loud to her sister. So by the second time we had dinner together on the second night, they'd read half the book. And like, that's just the greatest feeling. I know I don't have to worry about, I don't have to make excuses or tell them disclaimers. Now, if they went and saw one of my movies, and we were having an honest talk, I'd have to say, well, you know, I didn't really intend that. And, oh, you saw that movie? Oh, well, I didn't really write that part. And that isn't the way I would have done. You know, there's disclaimers involved, and there's none. And I have no disclaimers with Red Meat, and I have no disclaimers with my novel. And that is ultimately what you're getting at, is that you want to, I don't mind failing at all or having someone dislike it. I just want to have someone dislike it for the things that I intended.
Right.
So, you know, I'll give you an example. In the movie Gone, a lot of critics got really bent out of shape because there were so many red herrings. And they felt that every time the lead girl met a guy, that they all looked like rapists or killers. Well, I totally agree with them.
Yeah.
But you think I actually wrote it in my script? You know, she runs into this kid on a skateboard who looks like a rapist. She goes into a locksmith, and the locksmith looks like a rapist. I didn't write that. Those were decisions that were made by the director, the producers,
yeah.
Those people. They make those decisions, but I don't like critics attacking me for it. I don't think that's fair. So that's one thing I love about when you direct and when you write a novel. You know, you, the buck stops with you, and that's how I want it.
So Allison, when a critic criticizes a writer, so for instance, I watch The Newsroom, and I get real frustrated with Aaron Sorkin on that show.
But
now,
so do I.
Now, oh, good. See, there's a lot of us out there, actually, I found out with this. But, okay, so Allison, when I'm watching a show, when should I know it's okay to criticize the writer, and when should I step back and think, well, maybe this was a director's decision or an actor's decision? Because, you know, it's hard because we don't have the script in front of us.
Well, that's a great question, a really great question. And I once asked Andrew Lane that, the critic from The New Yorker, and he said, well, we just use the name of the screenwriter as shorthand because we have no idea who we're really criticizing because it's a collaborative art. But if it's Aaron Sorkin on television, then it's Aaron Sorkin because TV writers and creators are gods. And, yes, there's input, but when it's Aaron Sorkin, it's Aaron Sorkin, right?
Yep.
When it's Matt Weiner or something finer from Mad Men, I mean, those guys are really the gods of their shows, Larry David, you know, those kind of people. When you're talking about a studio movie, there is absolutely no way on earth, period, that writer had any final word on anything.
Right.
No way. So you really don't know who your critic is. Somebody smart once said, if you want to know who is responsible for a movie, you need to see their contracts. Because the person with the final cut, that's where the buck stops. And very often, and this I'm going to give you a little inside dope, very often the person who is making these shitty movies is not the director, it is not the writer, it is not the actors, it is an executive who is nameless and faceless. It is the head of that mini studio, it is the head of production of that big studio, and that person is all over that film, and they are unaccountable, except to their stockholders. Nobody in the critical community knows what they're doing, and they are in the editing room. They are in the casting sessions. They are all over the film.
Well, thank you for saying that out loud, because I think I sound crazy when I say it all the time on my show. But, yes,
I can't name names because it's too dangerous.
Yeah.
But, like, if you look at some of the play, look at the names of certain – let's forget the big studios because they're so huge.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the smaller studios. You know, there are a bunch of them that put out movies on a regular basis. If you see one of them, let's say, that puts out consistent C-level material, you have to realize that there is one person in charge of that place, and they are making every single decision, every decision. And they are all over it. And then every now and then there might be an exception to the rule, but that's usually because for one reason or another, it's a kind of movie or a filmmaker that person doesn't feel they can micromanage. But for the most part, that's what's going on. And so, I love it. Like some critic, I don't even know who it was, she said something like, I really loved, what was it? I think she said, like, I loved the story in Gone, but I didn't like the way the cops were acting and their dialogue and their scenes. So I'm thinking then I really loved, I think it was like, I loved the dialogue in Feast of Love.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking Alison Burnett couldn't have written that story I like, but probably, but wrote that. So maybe that dialogue, she was trying to figure out how she could like the story I wrote in one movie and not the dialogue, but love the dialogue in a different movie.
Yep.
And it didn't even occur to her that one of them was that drastically meddled with and one of them wasn't.
Yeah.
Or that the actors that were chosen weren't, whatever it was, there's all these variables. And it's so crazy to think that the writer who has no power at all, as William Goldman said, less power than the guy that at the security guard at the gate, that writer is somehow, that the buck stops with him. It's just absolute. And these huge critics don't understand it.
So
they're blaming writers for casting choices and for tone and for everything. It's just madness. And also often they do it also because they're writers themselves.
Yeah.
So they develop a bitter kind of jealousy toward writers who are working, and they want to bring them down. You know, so they just attack and attack and attack, and so they sort of eat their own. They attack the writer, and it's very common.
Yeah, that happens. I was going to ask you, you've worked with some great directors, though, Robert Benton. Let me ask you about that. Robert Benton, was he someone that kind of let your material go, you know, let your material go and didn't have too much input, or was he?
Okay, this is
how
this
was
is
it
ironic.
Working with them? Yeah,
everyone thought because Robert Benton had been a writer that we would have had a warm and fuzzy relationship.
Yeah,
I only met him once in the hallway. We were introduced, and I never spoke to him again until the opening night party.
Wow.
He attempted and began messing with my script, and the studio ordered him to stop. So he only messed with like the first 15 pages.
Yeah.
And never and didn't touch another word from then on.
Well, that's interesting.
I don't even know why they kept the first 15 pages he messed with, because he did things that were very significant that I think were mistakes. But he did it sort of on his own, and then they just said, no more, we didn't hire you to do the cease and desist, and he did. He ceased and desist.
And did you...
The only thing in the entire, like, rest of the movie is two people, lovers, who break up, see each other at a party, and they walk up, and they say each other's names. Like, let's say he walks up and says, Mary, and she goes, John. And, like, that's my pet peeve of all time. Is when people call each other by their names.
Yeah.
Because it never happens. It rarely happens in life. People can talk for 3 hours, and unless one of them wants to, like, says like, you know, Matthew, listen to me.
Yeah.
Rarely right. Do people use their name. So here are these two lovers have not spoken to each other like in 6 months, and they walk up and she says Mary, she says John, and I hate that line and I didn't write it. But other than that, every word of it was mine or from the novel, because I was adapting the novel.
Yeah.
So that was my experience. I didn't have any contact with Robert Benton.
No, I'm writing a pilot right now, and I found myself one of the scenes I'm writing, and I keep writing one of the characters' names. I'm like, what are you doing? And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like,
I mean, couples will say, oh, come on, sweetheart, or go, honey, come on. Like, they'll say things like that. It's like it happens every now and then. But, you know, when two people are in a sinking ship, like the Titanic, and it's sinking, and they can't reach each other, they don't scream, Jack, Rose, 75 times. They just don't.
Yeah.
You're looking at the person, you're making eye contact, and you're yelling shit like, hold on, you know, come here, stop, oh, my God, come, you know, come back. But you're not saying Jack, Rose. But writers do it all the time, and it's one of these little stilted things that writers do that makes a movie feel unreal. Even though the audience might not know why it's unreal, it feels strange and awkward. And you'll see it a lot. Boy, and it's the worst tick a writer can get into. Just put in parentheses to John or to Mary, parenthetical, and then you don't need to keep putting names before sentences and after sentences.
No, that's accurate. I totally agree with that. It's a pet peeve of mine, too.
Know about studio screenwriting, and I put into a 90-minute sort of seminar that where I'm talking on video, and I did it through this group called the LA Writers Lab, and it's just come available. It's like a $20 thing that you download or stream, and it's like a 90-minute talk about how to write and sell a studio spec script.
No, that's great.
Because I went on this roll where I sold 7 in a row over a period of years.
Jeez.
And I just give every tip I know in this thing. I don't even have the link. That's how new it is. But I think you could find it on a Google search. And I'm going to have it up on my website soon. But I know it just became available like last week or something.
Oh, that sounds
excellent. So I just wanted to say that in case anyone's interested, because for aspiring screenwriters, it's really a good thing.
Oh, I'm sure people will be interested. I mean, how the hell did you sell 7 in a row? Like, that's a streak.
Yeah, like, I didn't sell my first, you know, 13, and then I finally figured out what to do and how to do it. Gone was a spec script. Autumn in New York was a spec script. I had a Lifetime movie made that was a spec script. And then I've had about another 4 that sold that haven't either or will never be made or have not yet been made but could be soon. and they're in all different genres, and I just sort of figured out some rules.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to watch that myself because I want to pick up any tips I hear off that. You could probably Google the L.A. Writers Lab and Allison Burnett, and it could probably appear.
Yeah, I think
sure.
So. I mean, it's funny. I really even haven't tried because it's also new. I was on vacation, so I just sort of dropped out for 2 weeks, and I got this email saying it's now available, and so I can't remember. I think it's called something like, you know, something like, you know, selling it's something about spec selling. I just want to see if it's, I'm going to LA Writers Lab right now, and I don't see it offhand, but I know it's out there. I'll put it on my website anyway.
Now I was going to ask you, this is interesting for me. Okay. So we've now been talking for a while about how, you know, you're not always on set, you're not always super involved, and how you want to direct your own stuff. Okay, so Resurrecting the Champ, you work with my pal, Rod Lurie.
Yeah.
Was that a good experience, a not-so-good experience?
Well, it was a great experience in the sense that I think he made a really good movie.
Yeah.
And that's a rare thing. We didn't really work together. What happened was I was hired to write the first adaptation of this newspaper story that the LA Times ran about this boxer, this homeless man who had been a great boxer. I wrote the first draft. Tom Cruise was attached to it for a while. Various people got attached. Then it went into that long kind of development hell where it just kept, you know, other writers messed with. Chris DiRolmo did a draft. And then Michael Bortman did a draft where he added the whole thing about the guy getting a job on Showtime and becoming an announcer. And the big Michael Bortman's big contribution was the idea that the story about the boxer actually gets printed, because right. In real life it didn't get printed. They caught it. They caught some mistakes and it wasn't printed. And so he added that. And then Rod came along and heard about this story from Mike Medavoy and loved the story. And he read all the drafts. And Rod went through the painstaking job of knitting together everything that we had done, the best of it, and adding his own stuff. The father-son relationship was his. And at the end of that, the Writers Guild determined that Michael Bortman and I would share credit for both the screen story and the screenplay. And Rod and I talked a lot on the phone, but he really did he's an auteur. He did his own thing, went his own way. He invited us to an early screening. So, you know, we got a chance to sort of give him our take on things. And he was very inclusive and friendly and warm, and I like Rod, but it wasn't like a collaborative thing where we were in the same room.
Yeah.
But I was just really pleased to finally have a movie get made that I actually think is good.
Yeah, I think Sam Jackson got robbed of an Oscar nomination for that movie, to be honest.
Yeah, he was pretty amazing. I agree.
Yeah, he was fantastic. And I'm really...
I also really like Nothing But the Truth. Is that what it's called?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, the Kate Beckinsale movie Rod did.
For
really
whatever reason, those two movies did not get huge releases. And I got to tell you, I think it's some of Rod's best work. I really do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He just had really bad luck. And he also, he was at a time when drama was fleeing to television.
Yep.
Almost all drama is on TV now, adult drama. Hollywood has really become tentpole movies that cost, you know, $200 million and small genre movies that have a youth element. It's all about the youth. And then, sure, every now and then, you know, the Coen brothers can do what they want. There are certain – Woody Allen can make a movie for grown-ups. I mean, certain – you know, there are auteurs who are still in the club, but it's very – the studios more and more are not interested in drama, neither are distributors, and it's all going to TV. And more writers are working in TV, and fewer are working in the world of screenwriting.
Well, explain to me then, Allison, explain to me about – there was a report in the Hollywood Reporter recently where you had a new project picked up by New Line.
Yeah.
And someone said along the lines of Body Heat, which is something I've been talking to a buddy of mine about a lot lately. I think that's a great flick. But, okay, so
if it's not like a small genre movie and it's not a $200 million movie, why are they buying this script from you? What's so
because
great about this?
Because it's a small genre movie with
it
a
is.
Youth element.
Okay, it is. Okay, so it's like
That's just like Gone. I wrote Gone, sold it in 2 hours, and if it had not sold in 2 hours, there were other people that would have bought it because they told me and I believe them because, you know, they read it too. And why? Well, it was an inexpensive movie with a 20-something heroine that could be shot for a price in Portland, which is near LA, which is very union friendly. It's like movie tax friendly. I really designed it to sell.
Yeah.
Or I put it this way: I designed it to not sell. I didn't put any impediment up in the buyer's way. By the way, I designed the next spec I sold after that was a love story. It was about a 22-year-old girl who goes to England and falls in love with her Victorian poetry professor. And then dark shit ensues. Really castable. So many handsome young Brits who could play it. So many great young girls who could play it. A little more expensive because it's shot in England, but so what? And then this movie, I've never sold a pitch before. I never sell pitches because a pitch has to be such a good idea that even if you do a rotten job, they still want to own that idea.
Right.
Otherwise, if it's an execution piece that demands good writing, they can just say, okay, well, go write it, and I hope you write it really well, and I'll buy it from you on spec. But this idea was a very strong idea, and it was a youth-oriented. The girl in it is 17, and the boy is about 20 or 22.
Okay.
And it's an intriguing, sexy, romantic thriller. So it's very commercial
to
that audience that flocks to movies.
Now, Allison, do you feel like when you write for screen, like we were discussing the differences between your novels and between your screenplays. So when maybe your novel could be just about that romance, but when you write for screen, do you got to throw the thriller aspect in because a romance won't sell?
Well, the one in England is just mostly a pure romance drama.
Yeah.
But if I were writing something purely on spec with no producer, nothing attached, you know, I have tremendous freedom as a novelist. That's a reason why my novels have never been made into movies, because they're just way too original. They're not genre pieces at all. Even Undiscovered Girl doesn't fit neatly into any genre. I would never write it's a luxury. I try to say in my seminar that, you know, if you're writing indie films, then there are no rules except don't be boring. You can do anything you want in the indie world. It also might take you 10 years to get the movie made. The studio world is a different thing altogether. They're trying to create a piece of work that they can sell globally to a wide market. And so you really have to think in terms of what they think they can sell and make. And right now what they believe they can sell is genre movies. It's horror, youth-oriented horror, romance, thrillers, or giant tentpole movies. That's pretty much what they're making, superheroes.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's a very hard time to be a screenwriter right now.
No.
It's much better to be a TV writer right now.
You're absolutely right. I wrote a screenplay last year with the help of a buddy of mine, Mike Finder, who's a great writer. And he overlooked it, and he gave me notes on it, and we did multiple drafts. I turned it into a bunch of people. They love it, or some of them don't love it, but some of them really love it, but because it's a $30 million movie and not a $100 million movie, they don't want to make it.
It's really hard when it's in between.
Yeah, that's
really
what I
hard.
Found out.
It's better that it costs. I mean, honestly, I mean, there are some people out there that are looking for $2.5 million thrillers or paranormal movies that you can make, and then you market it for 17.
Right, right.
So then you're only in for, like, let's say 20 million, but you can open it on 3,000 screens.
Yep. No,
you know what I mean? You know, really, it's like I just wrote a horror movie. And I've never written one before, and I kept it really low budget.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm playing by
their rules.
Not. I'm writing things because I to satisfy what they want.
Right. Your novel.
You know, they want to make these things, and that's what they're looking for, so I give them what they're looking for.
Your novels, you play by your own rules. That's why you're directing Undiscovered Girl. You want to play by your rules.
But I'm doing that with the profits I made by not going by my own way.
You got to sell out a little, like John Huston used to.
Yeah, making a living in the studio world, like John Sayles.
Yep, John Sayles.
The perfect example. Yep. He writes novels, he makes indie movies, and he makes a shitload as a studio ghostwriter.
And I read John Huston's book. I don't know how much you know about John Huston, but I read a biography about him, and basically everyone's like, oh, John Huston made all these great movies, and then he acted in like some real shitty movies. Yeah, he did those really shitty movies so he could get the money to make a big movie. So he can make one of his
great
movies.
I did not know that. Yeah. I knew he made a lot of great movies, but I didn't know that his acting was largely like a way of feeding the other things that he did.
Yeah, he basically wanted to get more attention and more money for other movies, and that's what he'd do for it. And I think people are afraid of, quote, selling out, but I think you have to realize this is how the world works. You got to play by a certain amount of rules in order to do what you really want to do, and that's just the way it is.
Kafka has some quote that is roughly, in every battle with the world, take the world's side.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't mean like, you know, if the world is corrupt, you become an asshole. But it means when you're struggling, you know, like let's say you're an actor and you're just not getting work and people keep telling you you're too angry when you come into auditions. Don't just keep being angry and think you're going to win. Like, listen to the messages the world is telling you. And so many narcissists, which is what most artists are banging their head against a wall. Like they go, oh, well, Hollywood doesn't want me to write, doesn't want my heroine to have been, you know, incested. Well, fuck Hollywood. In real life, girls go through this and I'm going to write about it. Well, that's great, but you're not going to sell the script. So you're going to be an angry guy who's doing what he thinks is right, but you're not going to get it, you know. So you've got to figure out if you really want to write things to sell or to write things so you can sit in coffee shops and bitch about how stupid Hollywood is.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I just agree with you on all that. I think that's what you got to do. And you know, it's just hard, though, because what do you tell writers and people getting into the business who are like, well, isn't it easier for them to make a $30 million movie than a $100 million movie? Why is it $2.5 million or $100 million? Because I find a lot of writers that I talk to about this, they don't get it. It's hard to explain. Yeah.
Well, it is a little complicated, but if you make that $30 million movie, you still have to market it. And let's say you market it for another $30 million, you're in for $60 million, and you're not getting the swarms of people that show up for a $120 million movie, which probably, if it costs that much, is going to be heavy with special effects and action. And, you know, it's not just the number of money, it's what it tells you about the movie.
Yeah.
If a movie is a $30 million movie, what I think of is a movie that's probably got a few big name actors, and it's probably a drama. It could be a family comedy, you know, maybe, but it's probably dramatic. And there's a really good chance that when you start at $60 million, that you're going to lose money on it.
Yeah.
Because not a lot of dramas make any money.
By the way, Pat Tobias, who is one of my great producers, just sent me a link, lawriterslab.com/bookstore. You can, for $19.95, Screenplays That Sell, Secrets to Conquering the Studio Spec Market with Allison Burnett. You can download
that.
There you go.
So
there you go for that. You can download that. Is there
LA Writers Lab, and then you go to the bookstore. Okay.
And then AllisonBurnett.com, of course, where you can go to look for the novels, the films, the short fiction. You got your interviews, criticism. And I wanted to talk about the criticism. Okay, so you're an opinionated guy. I'm an opinionated guy. Has your opinion ever hurt you in the business?
No, because every single thing that I – well, first of all, everything I ever reviewed were books about Hollywood. I reviewed for Variety, International Variety. So I did, I don't know how many, maybe 12 book reviews for them. And there were books about people long dead. You know, one good thing that came from it is I reviewed Kenneth Tynan's diaries. For those of you who don't remember, he was a great, great critic from England who died fairly young, in his, I guess, early 60s or something. And he was hilariously funny. and I reviewed his diaries, and I got to meet his daughter, and that was nice because she liked my review. But, you know, I reviewed something about Orson Welles. I mean, none of this stuff is going to get me in trouble. The only time I ever got in trouble was after Autumn in New York. When it opened, it had been like a script of mine that I really valued. It was an original. It was protected for a long time. And yeah. Then about a week before shooting, Richard Gere had it rewritten by his own writer of his choosing. And it was 6 days or 7 days before shooting. And it was just, it was not rewritten well. And they just used chunks, just chunks of this other dialogue, sort of airlifted willy-nilly into the movie. And so I was pretty pissed about that. And so I wrote a letter to a few critics online, and one of them, even though I told her it was off the record, she sold it to Page Six of the New York Post, and they printed my entire letter. That was a little embarrassing.
Oh,
but I said some really outrageous stuff.
Well, you know, so what is it politically that you can do and can't do? Is a writer, as a director, as an actor, whatever. What is it, you know?
I think the thing, okay, I think in general, you know, I don't know. You know, we live in such uncontroversial times. I mean, so few working writers ever say a word to the media. Nobody cares what they think anyway. You know, who cares what a screenwriter thinks? I think if I had lashed out against a beloved actor, it could have really hurt me. But Richard Gere was pretty difficult. Nobody really gave a damn. If it affected my career, I certainly never noticed it. But agents and managers, they get very scared about controversy. They just don't want you going front and center and saying anything.
Sure.
You know? And so you'll notice, like, I don't go out of my way. Listen, people are spending millions of dollars to create this product. The last thing in the world they want is somebody involved in the creative team saying bad things about it. And I understand that.
Yeah, I understand that,
and
too.
And I try to be pretty discreet. I mean, I told you the truth about Roger Corman, you know, but so what? He's in his 80s. He doesn't, no one gives a damn. And George and Gregory Hines, may he rest in peace, is no longer with us. But, for the most part, I've learned some discretion as I've gotten older.
Yeah, I think that's the only thing left I have to learn is a little bit more discretion. I'm a little very open with my opinion. And
you're also sort of, you know, you're a critic of sorts, and you have a podcast, and you know, I don't think that's going to hurt you in the long run. I mean, I suppose if someone was thinking of buying your script and they Googled you and saw that you called them an asshole 7 years ago, they might care. But, you know, if they love your script, they're really not going to care.
Well, you know, it's a
I mean,
hard,
people want to make money.
It's
they
a
want
hard
to,
dance
they
for
want
me.
Succeed.
It's kind of like what you're doing. What I do is kind of, that's why I connect so much to your story, is how you write a lot of novels and short fiction and verse to have your own freedom, to do what you love to do, and then you write screenplays for money. It's like, I'm doing this podcast so I can get recognized, and in order to get recognized, I have to do the podcast the right way. I have to say things that may be controversial that people want to listen to. I have to be a critic so people can, you know, because there has to be a thought process to it. I'm not sitting here spinning records. But at the same time,
isn't that what Rod Lurie did?
Yeah, Rod did the same thing, and I want to act and write, and it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like sometimes I have my podcast hat on, my radio hat on, and I criticize someone, and then 2 hours later, I'm like, well, I'm never going to be in one of their movies.
So you live in Chicago?
I live in L.A. I'm in Chicago until August, mid-August, and then I come back out.
Oh, I see. I get it.
Yeah, I'm visiting. I got a baptism
great.
Thing.
I've been trying to work with young writers. I read a lot of scripts of people send me. I'm always looking to try to find things. I helped set up one. I didn't help. I set up one movie for a couple of unknown guys. And so I try to give back in that way.
That's
you know.
Right.
But I think in general, I wouldn't be too worried about the things you say in your podcast. It probably really isn't going to hurt you.
Good. Good. I hope not. Allison, I got to tell you, I'm so grateful you did this. I'd love to talk more when I'm in L.A. Maybe you can come
no,
in
I had
and
a
do
blast.
The show.
You know, anytime you want to, we can, you know, we can do this again.
I'd love to.
And, you know, because I work in different ways, I mean, directing is going to be a whole new thing. And once we have a cast, it might be really fun to talk about that movie. And, you know, we might even do some sort of talent search looking for our undiscovered girl. If we don't go with a famous one, we might sort of put out and try to get the word out to get people to send in their auditions and stuff.
Oh, I think that'd be great. I'd love to hear everything going on with the film Undiscovered Girl. I can't wait for you to make that. I think that'll be great for you. So.
Great, thanks. All right, so let's keep in touch, and thank you very much, and good luck with everything.
Thank you, sir, so much, and we will, and I will talk to you soon. All righty. Am I on? Thank you, Allison, very much.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, there's more. There's more of us just jibber-jabbering.
All right.
I need to learn when to turn off the recorder.
Hello, my heart.
So anyways, that was Allison Burnett. Alex, you listened. What did you think?
Very smart man. He's probably an extremely very good chess player. It seems like he does everything right.
Chess player.
Seriously, I mean, just everything that he does, he knows what to
Alex
do.
Alex sounds like an analyst on ESPN.
I don't mean to be the asshole in the room, but you know, being a very good chess player because he does everything right. I'm just going to throw this out here, but the reason why there's a league of chess is because people screw up and lose, to make the wrong move.
Lee Capreas is on hold. Do you want to say hello?
Yeah.
Hey.
How are you?
Hey, Lee.
I'm okay. I actually had a list of things that I had written down from hearing this show and last week's show of stuff Mikey said that was notable. And it's like a full page. My favorite was last week. He goes, there's this weird thing of people, like, sitting down and watching TV shows.
Hey, what was that?
You're breaking up, Lee.
You're breaking up.
Oh, fuck. What do I got to do?
Oh, no, you're good.
You're
just
good now.
You just keep talking.
All right. You remember last week I had written down when Mikey goes, I don't get this, people are sitting down and watching TV shows.
You don't get that? Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I was sitting in my car. I was waiting to go into a movie. And I said out loud, and anybody walking by in Encino would have seen me sitting in the car going out loud to myself, by myself, what is he talking about? What was that? Like, it just was very strange. But it's good interview. That was a very good interview.
Yeah, well, I know you've been writing, Lee, so what did that open up for you as a writer? What kind of advice did you take from it?
Well, I just think that one thing is don't be so worried about who you're going to piss off. And yeah, you have to play ball with the system to a degree and all that. And I thought that was good. You talked about appearing in movies and using that money to make your own stuff. That is such good advice for younger aspiring screenwriters and stuff like that.
Remember always about how you and I talk about John Huston, how he used to do it, and that was
I like John Cassavetes because he was in some terrible movies. I mean, he's great in Rosemary's Baby and Dirty Dozen, but he was in some shit, man, and he needed that money.
He plays a great scumbag in Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah,
he plays
Brian De Palma's The Fury.
Yep. So what else was on this Mikey list of yours?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this.
Before I get to Matthew Lillard.
Let's see. Let me refer to my notes.
There's no...
What were you just saying about chess games? What was that?
Alex was trying to sound really smart. He's an excellent chess player.
Sometimes you lose.
That was Mike. Just because somebody doesn't make a wrong move doesn't make him a chess player. Chess players make wrong moves all the time. That's how they lose.
Oh, man. This analogy has gotten kind of out of control.
Yeah, it has. Let's not relive it.
Hey, I took my pants off on Laurel Canyon the other day.
Wait, you took
that's
your
kind of
pants off on Laurel Canyon?
Hold on, was that
I was sitting in traffic, and it was just incredibly hot, and I was coming back, and I'd been in traffic on the way back from Cinefiles and in the Laurel Canyon from Sunset, and it was just that part where you're at that stoplight where you can really start going up the hill, and it's just bumper to bumper, and I got the windows open, I got no air conditioning in my car, and I'm wearing long pants because I hate short pants, and I'm just like, can't take it. So I got out of the car in traffic and took my pants off. I threw the pants in the car and got in the car. Some people were honking, but I didn't care. I had it. I stripped down the boxer briefs. I couldn't take it anymore.
took your pants off
driving? Wait. I think it's just because he doesn't have any AC, because it's been much hotter here than it has been in Vegas.
Yeah, but when you're not moving, though, I mean, it's pretty bad. It's not as humid as Chicago, but it's been really hot here, and I work outside. I had to get a haircut, man. I got my hair cut real short. I had to cut the hair off. I just sweat. Like, it's ridiculous. I'm sweating standing in line at the bank, like, for nothing, for no reason. Just involuntarily stand there, and sweat is dripping off me.
Oh. I sweat when I eat.
Yeah, you do sweat when you eat. Mikey sweats when he eats. Put that one on the notepad.
Hey, Lee, do you have an apartment yet? I saw you had to fill out an application or something.
Yeah, I've got lots of applications here. I'm looking for a place. What happened was a place asked if I was gainfully employed. And I hope you find somebody anywhere that is gainfully employed, okay? That's kind of a loaded question. But, no, it's been tough getting. I got to find a place to live, and time's running out. We'll get something, but, Why, you know anybody?
I can give you a reference from Chicago. You need a reference.
Could I put your name down and you can pretend to be a previous landlord?
I could. I am a landlord, so.
You don't think Archstone has good reviews for us, Lee?
Oh.
Are you?
Oh, yeah, no, I think they have great reviews for us.
Archstone you, Lee, for Nick Spees.
Yeah, right. One star, there's mold in the corner.
Where did you get the mold in the corner?
No, it was, get started. It was Nick.
There we go.
Nick.
It was Nick and his disgusting, filth-ridden life.
Whatever happened to Nick?
That's what my dad asks me every day, and I don't want to get into it. Yeah,
but I hope he fell down in a fucking canyon.
Hurt his neck.
None of us know where Nick is.
You know, nobody knows their next.
No, after he was fired, I never talked to him except for one time. Lee, what was the quote you said to him before I get to Matthew Lillard? What was it you said to him that one night at our apartment?
I said, what did I say? Oh, I say, pretty soon all this will be gone and we'll be separated and we'll leave you alone like your father did and like your uncle never did.
Wow. Damn night.
That's strong.
He was grinning and just like it was really creepy.
It was kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Start to smell like washing.
Am I coming in okay? I was kind of bad last time.
Yeah, well, he's old.
Hey, Lee, by the way, Tony and the guy said hi. I saw him a couple nights ago.
Oh, that's nice. Is that Luisi?
Yes, this is Luisi.
Hey, buddy. How you doing?
Good. They said hi.
Yeah, I miss those guys.
Well, I'll be back out in a few weeks, pal, and we'll be interviewing Alan Spencer, Dan Pasternak, Kristen Bell, and Dax Shepard. We're going to be doing a lot of interviewing.
That sounds good. I'm following some leads, chasing down the apartment. Oh, I'm selling toys this weekend. That was the other thing. I know you got to go to Matthew Lillard, but I'm selling toys at the Renegade Fair, the Renegade Craft Fair in L.A. A buddy of mine who has his handmade toy company sells wooden toys that he makes by hand, and I'm taking the booth for him this year. So I'm going to be selling handmade toys to little kids. What could possibly go wrong?
Hey, real quick before you go, how's the humidity out there? Worse than Chicago? Better? What do you think?
Oh, it's not. No.
Calm,
Chicago's
hold
been,
on. I want to get an
been
expert.
Way worse than L.A. All
right.
Yeah, he's an expert because he's been in Chicago.
Even here in the hot-ass valley, there's not a lot of humidity.
Take it easy.
It's been 90, 92 degrees some days, but it's not humid. It's incredible.
Any mosquitoes, Lee?
No mosquitoes.
We haven't had mosquitoes.
Yeah, it hasn't been that bad. It hasn't been that bad.
No, I think
so. We haven't been sitting out too much in the humidity.
You know why we have no mosquitoes? It's because A, it's been too hot, and B, it's been
too dry. Global warming.
Well,
so far,
if that's global warming, it better hurry up.
There's no mosquitoes here, but there are at night. You can see big, giant cockroaches walking around. That's not too good.
Palmetto bugs.
Well, that's...
Palmetto bugs.
Yeah, they call them palmetto bugs.
They're had any bugs in your apartment, though, right, Lee?
Cockroach is just so much more of a shocking word than palm.
No, but they're hanging out outside. Like, I see them on the porch. They're just, like, chilling on the porch. And I walk past, like, I got to close the door really quickly because I'm terrified of cockroaches. But they're huge, man. They're the size of a fucking pinto.
Yeah, I'm buying a couple cans of Raid.
And now, wait, hold on. I don't have experience with cockroaches here in Chicago.
Yeah,
no. Cockroaches here are smaller.
Yeah,
really small.
Yeah, you do. The Cubans are up north.
Yeah.
Oh.
We don't have. What?
You
are cockroach.
I'm just kidding.
We don't have
cockroach.
Yeah, we don't have cockroaches here. I think we just have regular roaches. They don't have the.
All right, for our listeners, to overtime. You can download us on iTunes at the Matthew Aaron Show. Please leave a comment when you do. Of course, you can follow us at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter and Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. You can like us there.
Like,
yeah, don't, don't like that. Matthew, we're gonna come back, and Mikey and Alex and I are gonna talk for a little bit.
God bless Kosovo.
Okay.
Kosovo blesses you as well.
Okay.
All right.
See you.
All right. That's Lee Capreas.
Good for Lee.
Okay. Good for, I love how he's talking about selling those handmade toys, and Mikey's like, uh-huh.
Actually, you know what came to mind while I was doing that? You remember in...
he's making handmade toys?
What's the movie with Jamie Lee Curtis, Tom Arnold? Arnold Schwarzenegger,
True Lies. True Lies.
Remember, there's that recording that he has.
Yeah,
Do it slowly. No, that's not the right. Recording.
All right, well here. Hold on one second before I play Matthew Lillard. I'm going to pause the show real quick. I'm going to say a prayer for my friends in Kosovo.
And
amen.
Amen.
And here is Matthew Lillard, Fat Kid Rules the World.
Scream.
Scooby-Doo. Hackers. Scooby-Doo. That's not awful. I've heard worse.
Thanks.
Your impressions are generally really bad, and that one was not really bad. So
I love you.
Let's not push it.
Yeah.
Let's not get crazy.
Yeah, quit while you're ahead.
Matthew Lillard, of course, she's all that. You'll hear all of it. I'm talking to him. He's in Hawaii. You can hear the birds chirping. He says hello to some strangers. He's like the mayor of this little street in Hawaii. Here's Matthew Lillard. We'll be back afterwards. Aaron, I am here with Matthew Lillard. We're going to try this again. We've been trying this for weeks, actually. We go back and forth, and I was actually supposed to talk to you the other day, and then that tragedy happened in Colorado, which was...
that was no bueno.
Yeah, that was awful, and I mean I think it really hit close to home because it's the movie industry too, which is, you know, that's our movie theater, that's where we're supposed to be protected and
sure.
I don't know. It's unfortunate.
It's not right in any stretch of the imagination. I mean, it's, you know,
right.
Another example,
right.
Of you know, just bad people doing terrible, horrific things.
Yeah, and then we had that other tragedy the other time we were supposed to talk. Fred Willard got caught in the movie theater. So it's just,
that's not so bad.
No.
He got caught in the movie theater doing exactly what we're supposed to do in those kinds of movie theaters. So that's a little that's LAPD at its finest.
Yeah, I agree. You know, that's so weird. They're a weird group of dudes, the LAPD. I love living out there and dealing with them because they won't arrest the people they need to be arresting, but they'll go in the tiki hut.
Yeah.
But, right,
yeah, they'll go. They'll, what is that guy? Why do we have to be patrolling that? I mean, does anyone really need to go catch those guys in that place?
Dude.
Yes, if they're in a park. Yes, if they're like a public bathroom at some, you know, place where a kid can walk in. Yeah. Dude, you're an adult theater.
Yeah.
You're busting guys in an adult theater. That is a waste of time.
I got to tell you, man, I've lived out there a while. I had no idea that theater even existed.
No, but I think we should have like a protest and have like a big fat circle, kind of everyone show up.
Big circle.
One time.
Yeah, you.
You know, we must.
We'll get you, me,
and
Lisa
up for Fred Willard.
do a whole circle.
No, that sounds great.
This is creepy. I'm stopping this line of comedy. This is creepy.
No, no, that's okay. We'll get you, me, Lisa Lampanelli, big circle jerk. It'll be fun.
Dude, I cannot hear you. If you can hear me, I cannot hear you again.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you keep going in and out. It's very strange.
I think I'm just going to fly to Hawaii, and then we'll just...
I think that that's better, yeah. I think we'll have a better chance. We'd sit there and drink Mai Tais and just talk about me, which is the most boring subject in the world.
I don't know. It's not boring to me. I got to tell you, I've really been looking forward to this one, because you are a guy who I find has had a really solid career, and I'm always interested by guys who want to make the move into directing. And you got Fat Kid Rules the World here, which I want to get into. But I do kind of want to find out, like, when did you decide you were going to start directing and why Fat Kid Rules the World?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, I think that you are either born to be a storyteller. Like, I think there are plenty of actors out there in the world that got into acting because they're incredibly beautiful. And it seemed like an illogical choice to move from wherever they were to, like, chase this dream of being a movie star. I was one of those guys that instead of getting beat up, I got into an acting class. It's a little different in terms of trajectory and what your end goal is, what you want to do, why you want to do it. You know, when I was in high school, I started directing. I directed plays when I was in New York City and L.A., and I've just always directed. Getting a chance to finally do it on the big screen took us 9 years to get it made. I mean, it took us a long time to get that opportunity.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like that thing that happened overnight or that thing where, like, oh, I want to just, you know, I don't know, do something different. It was a burning desire in me. And then I found Fat Kid, and I was doing the book on tape, and it was 9 years ago. And I had this emotional experience in reading that book that I just found myself relating to the hero of the book.
Yeah.
And I just felt like it was a story that had to be told. So, you know, I've chased it for, you know, like I said, 9 years. We finally got it done. And it's been the single greatest achievement of my, you know, of my career, for sure.
Yeah, I can kind of tell this was a big deal for you, but why 9 years, Matt? And I mean, I understand why you were so serious about it for 9 years, but how does it take 9 years to make the movie for people that don't know?
Well, you know, it takes, you know, look, our movie is about an obese teenager who finds punk rock music, and those are two things that Hollywood doesn't really know how to make a lot of money off of.
Right.
You know, and for somebody to invest the kind of money it took to do our movie, which isn't a lot. I mean, we're a very small, micro-budgeted film. I mean, we're, you know, we're well under $1 million. You know, to tell that story, it's like, you know, you have to find the right people willing to take that chance with you. I mean, I'm a first-time director. And, you know, I don't know. It's just one of those things that – I also think that for me it took time to find you know, I think that things come along in your life for a reason, and it was time for this to come along and happen in my life. And, you know, I originally started trying to do it at a $10 million level. I mean, I had just come off of Scooby-Doo 2 and Wicker Park and Without a Paddle. And for me, you know, doing a small movie was like $10 million.
Wow.
And our industry changed in the last 10 years. And so, like, you know, now we're completely able to do a great movie for less than $1 million. You can do a great movie for $100,000. I mean, you know, money is no longer the object. And once we figured that out, we finally found somebody to write the check.
Yeah, it's interesting with all the equipment today and everything, how much it's how easier, well, I wouldn't say easier, but you can make a film look a lot better for a cheaper amount of money nowadays. And
yeah, I mean, dude, if you know, we have a big SLR, and when, you know, we're in Hawaii with our kids, and I'm taking more pictures on my iPhone with my Hipstamatic than I am with my, you know, big expensive camera, you know, and
that's
just, technology has just completely changed. And being able to do things on digital, you know, cut things on, you know, you don't need an Avid anymore. You can cut things on Final Cut. And it's just, you know, look, the whole industry is kind of geared towards making these small films. And we were we shot up in Seattle, and, you know, it's the world of Lynn Shelton. And they make a lot of little movies up there, and they make them really well, and they have great people and great craftsman, and it just, you know, it all came together at the right time.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I love the cast for this movie, and that's what I wanted to talk to you about, is you're going to have to help me with the name here. Jacob Wysocki, right?
Yeah, you got it right on the nose.
Okay. Terry, I'm assuming you saw it, so you...
No, I didn't. I still have yet to see it, actually.
He's
not going to like that answer, but...
Matt, you got to see it.
You know, when we cast him, it was right before... Terry went to Sundance.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's kind of where Jacob had his breakout, like, last year. And, you know, I cast him because, you know, we had, it's a cool little story. We did a small version of the film. We did a short of the movie. And the idea of doing the short was to see if, A, we got along, you know, if the producers and I got along, B, if I could direct and see if it was a story worth telling. And we cast it between Christmas and New Year's 2 years ago. And we had four kids come in to audition for that part. And, you know, the part's very specific. Troy Billings is a 298-pound overweight teenager about to kill himself in the opening of the book.
Right.
And so to find that kid, you know, was no easy task. And he just has this ability to he's funny. First of all, he's hilarious. His work ethic is second to none. And then, you know, you just turn the camera on and he's just this angel of a face. And, you know, he is the core of the film, and he's just an unbelievable actor.
Well, let me recommend for you to see Terry, though. It's fantastic. I mean, I know you're a busy man, but it's really good.
Yeah, people love it. You know, he's a great director, and I didn't want to see it at the beginning because I didn't want to, you know, I knew that there were similar kids. You know, he's an outsider in high school, and I just didn't want to cross. You know, I don't want to accidentally.
You know what?
Tainted by what I saw from Jacob's movie.
No, I hear you on that because I'm really good friends with the director Mike Binder, and Mike and I are always talking about, oh, you're going to make this movie. Well, let's watch this, and this to prepare. And then it's sometimes like, but I don't want to watch this because it's too close to what I'm doing.
Yeah, and I also, you know, I wanted to, you know, if you're directing an actor, look, you know, there are things in that movie I desperately wanted him to do.
Right.
Like, there's a scene in the movie where he smashes these donuts against the wall, and he's got this relationship with, you know, food, and it's the end of the, you know, towards the, you know, end of the second act, and there's, like, a huge emotional point. And, you know, if that happened to be in... You know, in Terry, you know, I would have been crushed. So, look, I have to see it. You know, I think he's an unbelievably talented kid, and that time is coming.
No, that's great. What I also wanted to talk to you about was Fat Kid Rules the World. Now, you're not a fat guy by any stretch of the imagination. Were you ever a fat guy?
Well, I mean, look, I grew up heavy. I grew up in out of... You know, I was, you know, like you hear, I hate it when you hear actors like, oh, I was the ugly kid. You know, you're like, really? You're Jessica Alba. You were never really that ugly. I was talking to this girl a couple months ago. She's like, yeah, I was ugly when they gave me this modeling haircut that looked like a boy. I'm like, no, you don't know what ugly is. If you're a modeling agency is giving you a terrible haircut, you have no idea what ugly is. But yeah, no, I was an overweight kid. I had a learning disability, severe learning disability. I had braces and glasses. And the guy was not what you would call the epitome of great high school experiences. I mean, I found drama because, you know, I was the kid who wasn't getting his ass kicked, but I was next in line. I mean, you know, I wasn't far down the line. If that other kid transferred schools, you know, I could be on that. You know, the ass-kicking block. So, but yeah, and I also, you know, the movie's not about fat kids. It's not, it's about kids that, you know, it's just about kids that fit outside of the norm.
Right. So, but you felt like that was you, though, at one point in your life. Is that why you connected to it so well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm still that kid. I mean, you know, I'm the only, I'm the only guy in Hollywood that's never, you know, look, I go play Dungeons and Dragons. I don't go out to clubs and do a bunch of blow and, you know, hang out and party. I mean, I've just never been that guy.
You know, I've noticed...
I'm not saying that everyone in Hollywood goes to a bunch of parties and does blow, but, you know, that's the... I am not, you know, me and D&D get along much better than me in a party. And, you know, that scene, I mean, I've just always been, I beat my own drummer. But
the thing, though, is, bro, the fact that you call it D&D, you're legit.
Well, the fact that I play like once a month, you know, with my boys and my daughter and I are now obsessed with Magic the Gathering.
Oh, man.
Trust me, I am legit.
No, that's great. That's great. I mean, I kind of noticed, though, since when I moved to Hollywood, I'm like, where's all the partying? I would go to like a bar or a club, and I hate doing that stuff too. I'd rather stay at home too, and I'd play video games too. And you just don't see anybody, and you're like, this isn't what it used to be. I don't know. Has it died down in the last, like, because you've been around like 15 some years in the business. Has it died down?
I started at 22. And, I guess it's, I mean, look, I, you know, 20 years or something?
Yeah, 20 years. 20 years.
I was like 15. I've been around 30 years. Yeah, I'm working on it, though. But, yeah, look, our time, look, we're in this weird, repressed, corporate-run Hollywood. I mean, you know, if you look back on what Hollywood was in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so, you know, that was the way the world was run. It was run by artists. It wasn't run by MBAs, and things just operated differently. And there was less expectations for you to be, you know, corporate and professional. You know, now if you do a job at NBC, CBS, or Fox, good morning, people are walking by me. You know, you have to take a sexual harassment class for 7 hours.
Jesus.
You know, it's like sexual harassment in the 70s was how you got the job. You know, that way of Hollywood is gone and long gone. And
yeah,
you know, I'd say in my, you know, my 50 movies or however long I've been around, you know, I very, very rarely have I ever seen somebody not be able to complete a day of work because of, you know, partying too hard. And I think that was pretty standard back in the 70s and 80s.
Well, I kind of feel like, too, I always explain to people, guys like myself or Matthew Lillard, we knew we weren't going to fill Jack Nicholson's party shoes. We knew that was just like a losing battle. So what's the point? Why even try if you can't be the best?
Why even attack?
Yeah.
Why even try?
If you can't be the best, why do it at all? I was going to ask you, Fat Kid Rules the World, you got a campaign going on Kickstarter. Is that ceased or is that still going on?
No, we went South by Southwest.
Okay.
We won the audience award there at South by. And we, you know, we really thought that we were going to have a bunch of opportunities to release the movie. Like, we thought people would come along and buy it for lots of money and we'd be able to kick back and watch it just, you know, take over the world. That didn't happen. We had a great experience, but at the end of the day, the offers that we got from studios were all pretty terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, we got offers to distribute the movie, but all of them were like, you know, we wouldn't have a chance to make back our modest budget. So instead of taking a shitty deal, we went out and we, you know, struck out on our own, and we raised $158,000 on Kickstarter in 31 days.
Wow.
And, you know, we've been self-distributing the film ever since. We went to the Vans Warped Tour, and we became co-sponsors of the Vans Warped Tour. I don't know if you know what that is, but...
Yes, yes, yeah.
Vans Warped Tour is the longest-running concert series in America. And they hit 42 dates in 55 days over the course of the summer, and basically... You know, 90 bands play a day. Over the summer, we hit about 1 million kids.
Wow.
So we've been the co-sponsors of that. And then we did a deal with a company called Tug, which is a really interesting aspect of our film, is that any kid anywhere in America, across the U.S., from Anchorage, Alaska, to, I don't know, Florida, can go to tugthefatkid.com and can set up an individual screening of our film in their local movie theater with their friends.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's cool. It works a little like Groupon. So,
yeah.
You know, once you sell 5% of the box and see a cool movie in your theater.
Now, do you feel like that did real well for you going out and promoting it at Vans and stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, Mike McCready of Pearl Jam did our soundtrack.
Awesome.
We have, you know, Pearl Jam, Social Network. We have Kickstarter, Social Network. You know, we have 3,000 likes on Facebook. We have, you know, Vans Warped Tour with a million kids this summer and all summer. Like, we made this movie for these kids. We made this movie for disenfranchisable punk rock kids. It's about a punk rock kid, you know, an obese kid that finds punk rock music. So we made this movie for that demographic. And our whole pitch is, hey, check it out. We're trying to inspire ownership in the movie. Like, I was in a movie called Salt Lake City Punk, SLC Punk.
Yep.
And that movie did and has done so well over the years because nobody makes movies for those kids. And when you find an underserved demographic, it's our experience that kids will turn out and support it. So, look, we've been doing the Kickstarter for about a month now, and we have 900 screening requests all over the U.S.
That's awesome.
Good morning.
I am I'm the mayor of this little street. look, that's exciting. That's cool. And that's, it's a very DIY kind of approach. And that's like with us barely, we're just trying to figure out how the machine works. And so, once we start to try to put all these elements together and connect to the Pearl Jam kids and people and connect to, our Facebook people and try to inspire them to set up screenings. I mean, sky's the limit, and that's the exciting thing. And look, if somebody come along, Sony Pictures Classics had come along and said, hey, we want to buy this movie, we would have been, I would have sat back and said, okay, let's see what happens. But, that hasn't happened for our film. And so instead of like throwing it to the wolves, we're trying to think outside the box and reinvent the way distribution happens.
I think that's real rad.
It's cool. It's awesome. It's out. It's different. And we're just now starting to catch fire. And there's like this groundswell happening. That's really cool.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, it's not the ideal situation, but I think it's really rad that you're going out there and supporting your own film that much. It just doesn't always happen that way. And I think the interesting ways that you're going out to get it distributed and meet people and promote it, I think that's wild, man, and I think that's true indie filmmaking. So
you broke up at the end.
Oh, I would
you
say
think that's wild. And you think what?
I think that's true independent filmmaking. I really do.
Yeah.
I don't think it
I
gets
totally
more.
Agree with you.
I don't know if it gets more indie than that. So that's great.
Well, the funny thing, can I just say, look, it's funny because if somebody had given me $20 million to the movie in the studio system, I would have done it. But that didn't happen, so we changed the trajectory and do something different. If somebody come along and bought, nobody said yes to that. Why do I expect them to say yes on the other side? And so, it's the thing, you have to take ownership. And look, it took me 9 years to get it done. I see it happen all the time. Filmmakers like, I did my job. Somebody else has to do the next part.
Yeah.
The reality is there is nobody else to do the next part. So I have to continue it on, you have to fight on.
Yeah. I dig it. And by the way, Have your agents come to you and tried to get you now to maybe direct something studio? Are they trying to get you involved with that?
Yeah, I mean, I would nothing would make me happier than to do huge movies like Joss Whedon, John Favreau. I mean, if I could figure out a way to get to that world, that's what I want to do. I mean, I like independent film. I've had a blast doing this movie. But the reality is I like big movies. I see more big movies than I see small movies. And, as long as there's character in the story and, the part of directing that I like a lot is being able to lead a bunch of people in a direction to make something really kick ass.
Yeah.
And, that's what I want to do. So, I've started to kind of take meetings in that world. But the reality is, nobody's really seen the movie. I mean, we haven't even had a run. I mean, our first Tug screening was last night in Hollywood.
Wow.
So we're just now starting to kind of crack the ice. And look, if I had been at Sundance, my life probably would have been different. I may be hot, but I'm not. I've never been that guy. I've never been the guy that's like, oh, you know who we need for this movie? Matthew Lillard as an actor. I mean, that's never happened in my life. So
really?
I don't really expect it to happen on the directing side. And you just have to... your body of work becomes your proof, and hopefully the proof is in the pudding, and I'll get that opportunity. That's what I want to do.
Well,
but
you,
we'll see.
You bring up Joss and you bring up Jon Favreau, and you know, you've worked with some great directors yourself. Who did you learn from the? Because Jon Favreau tells a story that I heard him tell where he talks about how David Anspaugh from Rudy basically taught him everything he knew about directing. So,
wow.
Who did you learn from? Who did you pick up pieces from along the way? Who did you talk to when you were going to do this movie to kind of get some advice from and bring in on the creative end of things, help you out a bit?
You know, the truth is, for me, I mean, look, I wish I had that mentor. I had that mentor in acting. I mean, I have acting teachers that have inspired my entire life.
Yeah.
For directing, look, I'm not a big fan of people that talk about something they're going to do and just, you know, and never end up doing it.
Yeah.
And I talked about directing this movie for 9 years. So I was really gun-shy of going out and saying, hey, I'm about to direct. Look, I've done 50 movies or something, 40, I don't know what the number is, but even though most of them have been absolutely terrible films, you know, you learn via osmosis. I mean, you learn just being on set and experiencing that world. It's like a little like for me, you know, I kind of equate it to being a parent. I mean, you know, nobody tells you or sits down and goes like, okay, here's what you're going to do as a parent. You just are. And for me, you know, directing when I started to direct, look, and I've directed a lot. I mean, I directed a lot in theater and I teach acting all the time. So for me, you know, I had a really strong sense of what I wanted in terms of performance. And my personality was such that, you know, I've been number one on the call sheet enough to know how to lead a set and be a strong leader on set.
Yeah.
And so for me, you know, it was like a really, really, really honestly the most natural progression of anything I've ever done in my life. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was great. But you steal from the best. I mean, you steal elements from Wes Craven. You steal elements from Alexander Payne.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that, you know, I'll never forget Alexander Payne. I was like, what am I not doing right? Because we were doing take after take. And he's like, no, it's like Kurosawa. I just collect options.
Yeah.
And so there's a part of me that loves that notion of allowing actors to continue to try to give me new colors, different things. And I'm an actor that likes to do, look, I'm all over the place, and I like choices, and I like going big, and I like energy, and you know, so that's the thing I want from my actors. I mean, I want performance, and so yeah, but there are things like, you know, you get little tidbits from, you know, Paul McGuigan, who directed Wicker Park, brought in a bagpipe on the first day.
Jeez.
So I stole that. So I stole that as an actor for a long time. So the first time, if I'm number one on a call sheet, I'll bring in a bagpipe to bless the set. And so I did that as a director. So you steal little things, you know, fun little things and, yeah, you know, big ideas for people.
No, that's great. I just remember, yeah, I think the first film I saw you in growing up that I know that I like recognized you in that I was like, all right, that dude's cool was probably Hackers. A Hacker?
Sure.
Yeah, it was probably Hackers, man. And then of course, Scream, which, by the way, for me, I'm 28 years old, so that would have been, Scream would have been, I was 13, maybe? 13? So that shaped me as someone who wanted to go.
That's your wheelhouse.
Yeah, I remember, yeah, I had to show everyone that film. Because I'm going into film, man, and I'm going to act, and I'm going to write, and this is the film. And Scream was like the bomb, man. It was the best ever. And, you know, I just think it's really cool that you've done all these interesting projects throughout the years. SLC Punk, of course, you know, a movie I think is very underrated is She's the One. I mean, She's all that. She's the one.
She's the one. I don't think I'm in that one. Am I?
No, that's Ed Burns.
Yeah, no, actually, that's funny. That movie, you know, that's a movie that, you know, I mean, that's what blew Freddie Prinze Jr. up. And that was one of those things that the director, Rob Iskov, just caught lightning in a bottle and was the right time for that kind of, you know, 90s teen movie. And that's when Freddie was huge. I mean, he, you know, commanded everything he wanted at that point.
Yeah, and I don't think people know this, but Freddie was writing for the WWE recently, I think. I read that somewhere. So I thought that was wild.
So
I
you, caught up for a second there.
I was saying at one point Freddie was writing for the World Wrestling Entertainment.
Yeah, he's, by the way, WWE is making movies.
Yeah, they
are. Right now in our industry, that's a rare thing. There's not a lot of people making movies right now.
Yeah.
And so WWE is making movies and they're paying people to make movies. And I will say that Freddie Prinze Jr. has like one of the like, three most creative ideas I've ever heard for a cartoon and for TV shows and for a movie.
That's great.
So that kid is super creative. And, you know, he's just a kid that got stuck in 90s movies and, you know, it's kind of been crucified for him. But that's, you know, he's a bright kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, WWE is making films. So
I've been trying to.
It doesn't surprise me that those two have found each other.
No. I got to tell you, though, dude, you tell me. I'm interested in this. Did the 90s suck or no? Did they suck or were they great? I can't decide.
I don't know. I mean, I think they're like, you know, I think that in time we'll know more.
Yeah.
That's still being played out. But no, it's that thing. Look, that's when, I mean, there was an explosion in filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, right now, everything is, look, you get four tentpoles a year. And yes, The Avengers was fantastic. But really, John Carter wasn't that great.
No.
And so, you know, the good thing about the 90s is they just kept turning out movies. Now,
yeah.
Yes, some of them were bad, but some of them just, you know, blew your mind. I don't know. To me, our industry in the 90s was fantastic.
I agree with you. I was watching yesterday.
You know, and I, being the guy that had lots of jobs in the 90s, I liked it a lot more than the guy in, you know, the new aughts that doesn't have enough jobs, you know, to feed his kids. So
yeah,
let's go back to the 90s.
That's true. I just love the 90s because, of course, I grew up in the 90s. But I'm like yesterday, I'm watching this movie on Showtime called The Shadow Conspiracy with like Charlie Sheen and Linda Hamilton. And it's like, it's the worst movie.
You have a lot of time on your hands.
Yeah,
though.
It's really bad, though, dude. It's really bad. So I'm watching it because it's really bad. But I'm sitting there thinking, man, they don't make movies and release them in the theaters like this anymore. And I kind of miss it.
No, but that's, you know, and we can make a movie now for nothing. I mean, a kid in Iowa can grab a camera phone and make a great film and cut it and make a really amazing kind of artistic experience and tell a great story and could be the next filmmaker. What's broken right now is how much and how expensive it is to release films.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the problem is the reason that they keep making these huge tentpole films is they have to offset how expensive it is with deals at Burger King, with deals, you know, with Walmart. I mean, you have to offset the bottom line because it costs $300 million to release the film.
Yeah.
So you have to, you know, I mean, on a big platform like that, you've got to, like, you know, it's got to be a huge film. And that's why you don't see these little tiny movies getting out to everyone. And the cool thing, I think, right now is that we're just on the cusp of technology changing that. You know, if you could, you know, if it's movies on demand, you know, and you could at any time see any film you want, and that's what Tug's trying to do. I mean, Tug has, you know, if you go to just Tug.com, you can see Kurosawa films. You can see, you know, unbelievable 80s movies and 60s movies and, you know, old school black and white Charlie Chaplin shorts. I mean, you can request all these movies in your theater. So it's becoming more and more specific. And,
that,
you know, and that's
that
in direct relation to the fact that, you know, people keep trying to market movies to every single person on earth.
Yeah, that part's,
you know,
really
backlash
good.
To that.
Do you think it's going to get to a point, though, where, I mean, you'll have to do, like, traveling, like, okay, so you're distributing this movie independently, and not necessarily Fat Kid Rules the World, but let's say you do an indie movie. Is it going to get to the point where maybe you're not even going to show it in theaters? You'll go to Cinephile on Santa Monica Boulevard, or you'll go to Vidiot's, or and you're just going to put on a big screen and invite people to come watch it? Because, I mean, it's getting to the point where it's too expensive to distribute unless you're Kevin Smith and you go on tour and you pay $100 per person to see you talk.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, look, if that's, you know, again, that's Kevin kind of coming at it from a different place, right? I mean, he's trying to change. Look, I don't think that's the answer. I mean, I don't think, first of all, you know, a lot of independent films, you know, there's not somebody involved that you'd want to spend $100 to see.
Yeah.
But that's been real, you know, he's trying to change something because he's like, oh, this is broken. I have to do something different. But yeah, I think that it is, to be honest with you. I mean, I think it's exciting too. I think that, look, if you have a movie that speaks to a mass of people, like if you do a religious movie, if you do a, you know, gay-centered movie, if you, you know, not to put them in boxes because, yes, they're great stories, but if your target audience, and I think you have to have that, if you have like a super violent movie or super, you know, if you have a horror-centric film and you can touch your base and figure out a way, a social network, to let people know that this is out there, I do think that there's a lot of opportunities for films to bypass, you know, big release. It's a way to see a movie in a theater, which I still think is the greatest way to see a film.
Yeah.
That becomes an experience. I mean, that's, yes, we all have these home theaters that are fantastic, but it's not a shared experience.
No,
you know,
I agree.
Theater isn't done for one person. It's done for a mass of people because you have a shared experience with other people. So I think that to protect that and to keep that going for independent film, more and more opportunities to find specific ways to release it are going to pop up out of necessity.
Yeah.
And I think that's exciting because, look, it gives you an opportunity to find the movies that you want to find and see them in the way that they were designed to be seen.
Yeah.
Yes, you can always do, you know, VOD, and yes, you can always do video, and that's always going to be there. But, by the way, I said video, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
Nobody will ever
see video
tape again.
I say video too.
But, you know, look, it's just not another opportunity to see a film in the theater.
You know what I was going to ask you is you were talking about how you were you're an acting coach. Now, first of all, I didn't know you teach acting classes. How does someone get involved?
Yeah, I teach at a place called the Vancouver Film School, which is my shameless plug for that institution. I'm not really a coach. It's like I'm a teacher, so it's different than, like, I don't go in per part and go, hey, this is what I would do on this line. I teach like a class of,
you go in for a semester,
whatever, 1,500 kids.
Yeah, you go in for a semester and talk, huh? Is that how it works? Do you go in for a semester and teach? Are you like an adjunct or?
No, I do like a master class series. So,
oh, okay.
Like I'll go, I'll fly up there for a weekend. So we'll work Friday for 4 hours, Saturday and Sunday for anywhere between 8 to 10 hours.
Oh, that's rad.
And, you know, it's usually about.
Okay, I just want to warn everybody listening, we're going to go into overtime in 4 minutes. You're going to have to download it on iTunes to hear the rest of the interview with Matthew Lillard and to hear Mikey and Alex and I talk about stupid questions on Yahoo. All right.
You know, it's a thing for me that, look, when I'm not acting, you know, I'm 42 years old. I'm a driven type A personality. And you're, as an actor, you're always waiting for somebody to give you an opportunity to act.
Yeah.
And yes, you can sit and read plays by yourself, but it's really about, you know, it's about the fellowship of actors and being around people. You know, it's a full communal sport. I mean, you can't, you know, it's not really something designed to do by yourself in your room. It's not like a writing exercise. So, you know, So in light of that, you know, in my life, I was like, I can't sit around anymore. I mean, I'm getting way too good at Xbox and PlayStation, and I've got to find something else to do.
Well,
and so,
great,
you know, that for me is a way to go back, and I teach, and I'm a better teacher than I am an actor.
Can you tell me about The Descendants, which you worked on with Alexander Payne and George Clooney, nominated for a bunch of Academy Awards? Good film.
On the day The Descendants was nominated for whatever, 6 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
It was my birthday. So it was this year. I turned 42.
Wow.
I got up early with my kids and we watched it come out. And that day my dog got run over by a car.
Oh my God.
Which was the best day ever and the worst day at the same time. Dog's fine.
Oh, that's
good.
That part's
not
good.
To bring everyone down, but the dog just ran in the middle of the street. I was like, oh, gosh.
Yeah, that always scares me too. But yeah, I did just want to compliment you on that. I thought you were great in The Descendants. And,
oh, thanks.
And I think and now you're working with Clint Eastwood. You got Trouble with the Curve, right?
Yeah, Trouble with the Curve comes out this October.
What's your role in that?
It's weird. I get like every third word out of you. That's why I'm talking so much, because I can't hear a word you're saying.
No, I like that you're talking.
What'd you say?
You and my fans like that you're talking more than I am. So what's your role in Trouble with the Curve?
So I play his nemesis. So Clint Eastwood and I are both baseball scouts, and he's an old school baseball scout, and I'm the young jackass baseball scout. And we have a different opinion on a guy, and shockingly, spoiler alert, he's right and I'm wrong. I know that's weird. I know that's super strange that Clint Eastwood, hero of all heroes, movie star for the eons, is right and I'm wrong. But it's good. It's Amy Adams and John Goodman and Justin Timberlake. And it's a really great little movie. And I'm excited for it to come out.
That's great. I'm really proud of all the work you're doing, Matt. Fat Kid Rules the World. When are we going to be expecting that? So where can everyone go to find out when they can see it, what they can do? Give us all the information.
If you go to tugthefatkid.com, so if you go to T-U-G-G, thefatkid.com, you can send a request for a screening in your local cinema, any theater, any time. And then we will go out and set that up, and then you have to go out and sell 60 tickets, and then you make money. You make 5%. So, look, any support you guys can give, that'd be fantastic. We're excited. The movie's badass. The movie's great on all levels. It's funny. It's got a story to tell. It's, it's fast. It's not really long and laborious. And, people love it. So, the good news is that I'm out and I've done it enough to pitch really bad movies. I mean, I did radio tours for, The Name of the King, A Dungeon Siege Tale, which is the worst movie ever made. And, it's nice to be out talking about something that, A, I'm proud of, and, B, people like. So if you go to tugthefatkid.com, you can set it up and enjoy it.
That's great, and that's Tug with two G's. And the Dungeon Siege movie, Uwe Boll's done worse, so you're okay.
He has done so much worse.
He's
Red
done
Rain
a lot worse.
Unbearable. I'll never forget, we were doing Dungeon Siege. He's like, I want to show you my new movie. It's genius. I'm like, oh, that sounds great. And he rented out this little theater in Vancouver and invited the entire casting crew to see it. And I sat next to him because I love – if anyone's ever worked with him, I love him.
Yeah.
So I sat next to him. I was going to, I can't wait to see this. Vampires, I am a D&D geek. And 5 minutes into the movie, I went downstairs and bought a six-pack and came back up. I'm like, I have to do this. So the worst movie ever made was definitely Blood Rage, but quite possibly maybe the second or third worst movie ever made could be – Dungeon Siege in the Name of the King.
And by the way, I totally forgot, by the way, it was just on my mind. I brought up She's the One on accident instead of what the fuck? What's it called again? She's All That?
She's All That.
She's
I
All That.
How much that movie means to you.
I know. I really did like the movie, though. Oh, fuck. But you were in The Groomsman with Ed Burns, so you did work with Ed Burns.
Yeah, Eddie Burns. Yeah, great movie. Yeah. That movie... That has that's one of those elements that my agents are like, did you see him in The Groomsman?
Yeah.
He doesn't always have to be a spaz, spazzy jackass of an actor.
Yeah.
They use the proof of that
man.
For years. Now they have Groomsman, and soon they'll have Trouble with the Curve. But yeah, that movie, Jay Moore is unbelievable. Eddie Burns is great. I love that film.
I was going to ask you, did you talk to Ed Burns at all, though, about distribution for your film, because how he just did his last film?
No, I didn't. That's the thing, though. Look, I'm not that guy. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not that guy. Maybe I should have, but hey, what? But we cut the trail that we saw fit, and we talked to a bunch of people about Tug and how that relationship was, but at the end of the day, we just we did it on our own.
Well, I got to tell you, I think the way he did his last film, I mean, he basically stars in it for free, filmed it for like $9,000, and put it on video on demand. I mean, that's crazy, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, who else is in it, though?
It's pretty much him. It's him.
Right.
And a bunch of
the way our industry is going, I really believe that's going to be, I'll be the actor, you be the director, you be the writer, we'll get another actor,
yeah.
And there's four of us. Let's all pool our own money, and we'll do it ourselves, and we'll build it on our names.
It's crazy.
You know, you'll do it for nothing, or you'll go to the crew and be like, look, we'll take, 50-50. We'll be the money. You guys do the labor. Everyone works for free, and we all reap the rewards on the upside.
And he did it for...
that's where we're going.
He did it for $9,000. He had to have made his money back on it. Had to have made $9,000.
Sure, back. Yeah, for sure. But he's, $9,000 doesn't mean anything to Ed Burns.
No, it doesn't.
Ed Burns can trade on his name. I mean, he's a celebrity.
I think that's great,
I'm sure there's other people in it that he was like, hey, I'll get, come do this movie for free. And when it comes out, I'll kick you back a piece of the backside. And that makes sense. I mean, that's a great way to make the movies that Ed Burns is making.
Do you think that could be a possibility for your future as well, is to find scripts that you like and just... I mean, in this film, you got Billy Campbell in Fat Kid Rules the World. Billy Campbell's great, and Matt O'Leary. So you could call in a few favors, I'm sure, whatever. Do you ever think of making films, like, on the cheap and doing it that way?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the same thing Lynn Shelton was doing. I mean, Lynn Shelton is the grand dam of Seattle filmmaking, and an amazing woman, and has this incredible spirit, and Seattle is her town. I mean, she is the local filmmaker of this era, this decade, and that's what she's doing. And she's making her movies that she wants to make with no influence from studios. She's making them with really great actresses. I mean, Ellen Page was just doing a movie. My Sister's Sister is a great film. And she has a group of people that will bet on her and believe in her, and they'll go on these journeys with her because they know she treats them fair. And when the money comes back, she pays them.
Yeah.
And look, that's a great way to make a movie. It's, first of all, you can make your own films.
Yeah.
You're not subject to notes there's nothing wrong with notes, but you're making independent film the way it's supposed to be made. You're telling the story that you want to tell, that you're inspired to tell. I mean, there's a movie at Disney right now that I'm talking about maybe doing. It's a great movie. I'd love to do it, but it's not the movie I would ever write.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to figure out how to make those kinds of movies your films. And I think that's, as an artist, the task and the journey between how do you make money and feed your kids and how do you do your art? And it's a very tumultuous journey. And it doesn't always work out well. And sometimes you do movies that will pay the rent, and like Uwe Boll's In the Name of the King and Dungeons Each Tale. And sometimes you get to do movies like The Groomsman that you're inspired by. Or look, Alexander Payne, George Clooney film. Yeah, doing that movie for money. I mean, nobody made any money on that movie. I mean, those two guys did, and they made it on the backside, but they didn't make money up front. They made it because they were, inspired to make it. And I mean, nobody's worried about George Clooney, but it's not like he doesn't take $20 million up front. He takes no money up front.
No, he doesn't take any, yeah. That's something
and that's the way
know.
He's able to make the movies he wants to make.
Yeah, that's
he's like,
cool.
I'll take nothing. You don't have to pay me. I'll take it on the backside in success.
Yeah, Tom Cruise does the same thing. I unfortunately cannot do that. I wish, but when I do a play or when I do a short, I need the check to clear first.
Your big appearance fees.
Yeah, my
big. Aaron, thank you, dude. Thank you for letting me blither on it. Well, I have no idea what you said this entire interview, but I hope you were nice.
Matt, I gotta tell you, hopefully you can hear me before I go. But I would love to have you come in to Coney Dog on West Sunset and do an interview sometime for when Trouble with Curve comes out.
That'd be great. Get in touch with me, Matt. We'll make it happen.
Thanks, brother. You were fantastic. And Fat Kid Rules the World. I can't wait to see it, too, by the way. I can't wait.
Words. All right, brother. Thanks,
thank
man.
You. Have a good day.
Bye, pal.
Ha, ha, ha. All right, are we back?
I mean, remember,
we're back.
That's good.
We're back.
I love that guy.
Yeah, Matthew Lillard.
His cool. voice is sweet.
Wait, I know Mikey likes hearing himself. Go ahead, Mikey.
Thank you.
I do. You know, I like hearing
he
myself.
He sometimes thinks he's not on if he can't hear.
Yeah, I'm always like, hello?
Adam,
hello?
Adam, turn it up. Turn
I
up.
Love Matthew Lillard. I
no,
think he's great.
He's great. He really is good.
He was great in The Descendants.
Yeah.
Real good performance.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that, Alex, The Descendants. No, you couldn't sit through
he
that.
He seems like the kind of guy
you
I,
got too
I
much
just want to go hang out with. I want to be like,
right.
Hey, what are you doing tonight? You want to go like
he's playing Dungeons and Dragons, yeah. according to him.
Oh, yeah.
And
right.
Magic the Gathering.
I'd be like, dude.
No, he really is.
That's what I'm talking about. I want to be like, come over and be like, dude, I'm stuck in, you know, Chrono Cross. Can you give me a hand here?
Chrono Cross.
He'd be like that guy, like, you know, just to go mess around.
Yeah.
Screw with somebody. Hey, we're going to screw with that guy. All right, I'll come. Let's do something.
Look, and anytime anyone wants to come on this show and promote anything with fat kids in the title, go ahead.
Absolutely.
I'm all for it.
Do you feel like, you know, I hate to say this, but sometimes I kind of feel like there's a special fat gene. And like, some people are fat just because they like to eat.
This is going on Lee's list.
And I'm serious. But I think there's like a...
Lee!
There's some sort of something... to being fat, because there's some people like you see it, and all fat people know they watch the people who eat everything and never gain weight.
He's looking at me.
You ever think people consider us the jolly fat guys?
But hold on. Here's what I'm saying though. I feel like at a certain extent, sometimes fat guys like me and you,
mm-hmm.
we're like our own race of people.
We are. I hate to sound prejudiced or whatever.
Yeah,
but
I feel it right over here.
I have a proclivity towards fat people before anyone else.
Yeah,
I will help a fat person out way before I help anything people.
Well,
out.
It's like a guy. Walks,
no offense, Alex.
A guy walks into the subway.
If it's between you and Mikey, and one of you needs help immediately, Mikey gets dibs. It's a proclivity to fat people.
Well,
I also have a proclivity to bald people.
I have a lot of friends. I think I have special connections. Dave. Big Sean.
Mm-hmm.
I think half the reason is why we get along so well.
Lenny.
It's because where we sit around, I'm like, man, you know what sounds great right now? How awesome would it be to get like some smoked Gouda cheddar mac and cheese? And they'd be like, dude, that sounds great. And next thing you know, we're all
to
get something to
but
eat.
But not all foodies are fat.
So this is like
No. There's fat guys inside everybody. See, the food.
There's fat
see,
guys inside
it's
everybody.
Like, it's like Italians, you know, and I speak for just from, you know, personal experience. All Italians are fat boys at heart.
Mm-hmm.
Some just got the metabolism to go along with it, and some didn't. That's just kind of how it is.
Okay. I agree.
I mean, I'm wrong.
No, I don't disagree.
So you guys are calling me the skinny friend out of the group? I'm the skinny
no,
friend?
No, trust me. You're not the skinny friend. You're the stupid one, but that's
okay.
Oh,
take it easy. Like,
you know, I know a lot of skinny people that wear Zubaz, so.
Zubaz?
Yeah, the Zubats. The Zubats. The pants.
Oh.
The like zebra pants or the
oh.
or they got the tiger
oh, you mean,
pants.
Yeah, the WWF special from 1994.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
What were those Cavaricci's? What were they?
Was there another brand?
No, Cavaricci's were the
I didn't know they had more
those
than
were,
one.
Those were the popular jeans in the 80s, I think.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't know anything popular.
I don't know. All right, but so I have a question. So What's with this Yahoo questions? Remember you brought it up earlier.
Oh, okay. So I thought we'd start a new segment on the show, and if people like it, we could keep doing it.
God, you know, I feel like this is going to be one of those segments that just does not give any hope for the human race.
It is. It's one of those segments.
No.
This would be a really good segment on, like, a late-night TV talk show.
Well,
like, this is like a Letterman segment.
It is like 11 o'clock.
Yeah, but basically, Adam and I, we were during the interview, which was pre-recorded, so I've heard it. I did it. And Adam's doing the soundboard, and I'm going through Yahoo, and I'm looking at questions on Yahoo. And Adam, I'm pointing to Adam. I'm like, read this. They're like the stupidest fucking questions on this fucking thing.
Yeah, I can't believe that some of the questions people ask.
Well, how smart are you to begin with if you're going on Yahoo and putting a question in a message board?
Yeah, well, and it's not like Yahoo is necessarily the local authority for any one specific item. Like, I'll give you a proof of it. If you want to know about steroids, you don't go and ask Yahoo questions. You go on to like a steroid
right.
message
right.
board, and you ask people taking steroids. So,
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you and Alex some of the these are totally real Yahoo questions that were asked on Yahoo.
Okay.
And then I'm going to get the answers from you guys.
All right.
So we can help these people in need.
I have my guru, which with age comes wisdom and spiritual enlightenment.
Okay. Here's the first one. If I had unprotected sex with a heroin addict, do I have AIDS?
Yes.
Alex, what's your answer?
It's a gray area.
It's a gray area?
Now,
do I have AIDS?
Can you answer a question with a question?
Sure.
Did the heroin addict have AIDS?
Well, that would be that's why the question's so stupid.
That's
yeah.
a logical question.
I just
did the needle have AIDS on it?
I don't know.
What?
Exactly.
Did the needle have AIDS on it?
Did he have sex with a needle or a heroin addict?
Hold on. How do you have AIDS on a needle?
Wait. I have a question.
Is that a new dollar menu item?
I'm trying to make a point.
On a needle.
Hold on. Let's read between the lines.
Stupid question.
Hold on. The question just states is that, you know, do I have AIDS if I had sex with a heroin addict, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or unprotected sex. Okay. Well, at first I'd say this guy must have had sex with a whore who was a heroin addict. But it was unprotected. And whores are pretty good about making sure you wear a condom.
All right.
So
that means... I can give you specifics to his question. He wrote a paragraph of what it means.
This means his girlfriend's a heroin addict.
All right. He's saying, if I had unprotected sex with a heroin addict, do I have AIDS? So, the other day I got really drunk and had sex with a heroin addict, and he didn't tell me. And he didn't tell me.
Wait, who wrote this question?
His name is Poop Jones.
He's got AIDS.
Okay.
100% AIDS.
Okay. I got really drunk and had sex with a heroin addict, and he didn't tell me until after, and I neglected to ask him if he ever shared needles or anything.
Next.
And then I proceeded to do it again the next night. I know I'm an idiot for doing this. No one has to tell me that. But can someone please just give me advice on what I do in this situation?
Get checked.
Do I have AIDS? I found a weird bump on my vagina, and it kind of stings, burns when I pee. I don't know if those are like symptoms, but I'm really nervous. And also, when I've been peeing lately, like today, it's been burning so bad, and when I wipe, there is blood on the toilet paper. I left out that I had unprotected sex with two other guys in my lifetime, and they both are not the cleanest people in the world. I don't know if I have AIDS now or just every single STD in the world. I don't know what to do, and I'm scared of the results I might get. Don't judge. So this is a woman who had unprotected sex with a man who was a heroin addict. She does not know if he has AIDS, but she wants to know, does she have AIDS?
Look, if some like ghostly, gangly, Skeletor-looking motherfucker that's a heroin addict is getting laid, and my fat ass isn't getting laid, find me a gun, because I'm done.
No count. Next. There's got to be a better question.
Yeah, no, actually, after that huge paragraph you wrote, let's just go to the next question.
Next question.
Okay, so I get warts kind of gross, but there's this one that I've been scratching so it got bigger. Anyways, now it's red and it's kind of bubbly with pus. Does duct tape really work? How can I get the wart off? It's red and it looks like a bubble. I think it might pop, but what should I do? I put something on it, like in a Band-Aid, for example. Help. I don't know what to do. Oh, and I'm going to the doctor, but not today. Thanks and explain. I'm only 13.
We've heard about the duct tape.
Yeah.
Supposedly it might work.
It does work.
Duct tape works.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Okay, next question.
So you beat that one real quick.
Can I ask
a question?
No.
Why does a 13-year-old have warts? And why is he going on Yahoo to ask how to remove them?
Probably because he's fairly embarrassed about them, and at 13, there's plenty of kids that get warts.
Yeah. That's a very common thing.
Yeah.
All right. My girlfriend had her vagina waxed today. It felt weird. It's like doing a 12-year-old girl. Should I stop her from getting a Brazilian next time?
No.
What?
Mikey's outraged.
He's gay.
What the hell kind of question is this?
He's gay.
Well, he feels that it felt like he was doing a 12-year-old girl, and he doesn't want her.
So your perfectly of-age girlfriend who makes just clears off the fucking...
Clears the runway.
It clears the runway. So you can just go have a slip and slide in a good old time, okay? And now you're going to feel guilty because it feels like you're having sex with a 12-year-old?
Maybe.
Well, here's a question, sir, who wrote this question. How many 12-year-olds have you had sex with that you know it feels like having sex with a 12-year-old?
You fucking scumbag.
There's your answer. There's your Yahoo answer from Mikey.
Maybe he needs a runway.
All right. I really need someone to help. Around October, I went to get a pap smear and found out that I have gotten chlamydia from an ex. But anyways, I got it taken care of. When it was taken care of, I eventually masturbated with one of my sex toys. And I forgot that, or I think I used it when I had chlamydia, when I didn't know I had it. And now I'm feeling pressure in my lower stomach area and on my left side of my back. When, and I don't know if I got chlamydia again because use of my sex toy and got it there, or because I work out every day for 30 minutes and that's causing the pressure in my lower stomach.
Well, apparently this girl doesn't have any sanitary, you know, habits.
Lysol.
Because if she had to go like any extended period of time without using her dildo and she got chlamydia again, that means she doesn't clean her shit.
It means she doesn't clean her shit.
Lysol, white pads.
Needless to say, she doesn't know anything about going down like power windows. At least none of her boyfriends do.
Oh, yeah.
Go down power windows. I always love that one. I love these STD questions. Oh, yeah, the computer one. Okay. All right, I'll get to the computer
one. No, that's so stupid. You already know the computer one. Some fucking 80-year-old man who bought a computer when he was 60 in 1993, okay? He wants to know if he can watch internet porn now and he wants to update his computer. I mean, who cares? I have a computer from 1993. I want to play Xbox Live because my grandchildren watch porn, and I'd like to do that so I don't have to go to the Tiki Hut anymore.
The Tiki Hut.
Okay.
With Fred Willard.
Next question.
All right. How do you tell the girl that her vagina smells?
Listen, broad.
No,
this shit smells.
No. Let's be serious about this, Alex. That actually
sounds... This is a real problem. Mikey's going to confront this. This is a real problem.
Well, there's a couple problems with this problem. A, if I'm with a girl I really don't care about, you know, like situations. Sometimes I don't ever make my way down there to find out. I just kind of go for the goal and just you know, and then at that point it becomes a race where I finish his first win and it's nap time. And
salami sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know. But if it's a girl that you care about, here's what I would do. Here's kind of my thing. If it's a girl that you're dating and you like really like the girl, I would probably, but it depends on how bad it is. If it's like, hey, I'm going to go, oh, my God, if it's like one of those situations, she might figure out right away. But, you know, if it's like kind of bad. Then
hey, Alex, how do you tell Megan her vagina smells?
Well, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
yeah.
But you know, I'm sorry. I get a point here. My point is that I would have to say I'd give it like another day. I'd wait till like the next couple times.
Why don't you just get a job at the fish docks and you'll be fine. Get a job at the fish market.
I got an old saying for you. If it smells like fish, it's a dish. If it smells like provolone, leave it alone. Okay.
I mean, if she's baking a loaf of bread, I'll tell her. You know.
You know, all I'm saying is, if it's bad, I'd give her another chance.
Okay.
And maybe three tops. I mean, I wouldn't be going down there again.
Three.
But I'd do like the check, the ninja. I call it like the
ninja.
The ninja. You know.
He just put two fingers in his.
All right. So, Alex, you don't need to be involved in this question. This is from Lynn. Is there such a thing as a girl getting too wet? You wouldn't know. Mikey.
Never, never.
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 Thanks.
Would you know anything about that, Alex?
No, you can never get too wet.
I think you should just bathe in it, you know, when you're in that moment, and then just go take your shower.
Exactly.
I love this question. Someone actually posted this. Linda, another woman. What would happen if you don't shower every day? This is actually a serious question. No, this has nothing to do with me. I'm just curious. Let's say you didn't shower for a month. Other than being smelly, what would happen? Specifically in the vaginal region, would you develop bacterial vaginosis, yeast infections?
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Luisi?
I would say most definitely.
How would you know?
I don't even want to answer this question.
it's too disgusting.
I don't want to.
God. If anyone heard that, Adam just said it'd be like ripping apart two bad grilled cheese sandwiches.
Okay. How do I tell my mom I'm sexually active? This is from Jewel. I'm 13 and I don't have a boyfriend. I just had sex with my cousin's best friend, who his cousin, I think, anyway. I want to tell her because I know I'm going to have more sex, and I don't know how to tell her or anyone. The only one who really knows is my aunt that I'm, like, really close with. So how do I tell her? Oh, and I always use protection, and the boy I had sex with was only 14 or 15.
Why can I never be that cousin?
leave kind of rappers laying around.
You know, I think the best way to let your parents know you're having sex is to have them catch you.
Yeah,
leave them catch you?
Leave kind of rappers laying around.
I think that's a very solid answer, Mikey. I really think that's a good one. I think that is a great way. You, icebreaker, okay? You don't have to say anything, and then
no,
it's just like, oops.
There's no explanation.
Oh, damn,
I mean,
shit. Ah.
It's like, here's the way you can look at it. When the pool water's cold, and you know it's pretty fucking cold, and you know no matter what, it's going to be cold. You can either you take a 2.5 hours of dipping your feet in there and then laying on your stomach and getting your arm in there
getting the balls.
Before you finally roll in there. And then once you finally roll in there, it's fucking still just fucking cold. Or you can just jump in from the beginning and get the cold part out of the way.
I feel like we need Ron Zimmerman for this segment.
I feel like he'd
have all the right answers. Here, well, this answers Gary's question. Mikey kind of answers Gary's question here. How can I test if my son is gay? I'm worried my son might be gay. I want to get him checked. Isn't it possible to get a hormone check, a vocal cord check? Can't a doctor indicate if he is gay or not? My son has almost no muscles and narrow shoulders. He also has blue eyes. He talks in a very high voice, and while he sings, he sounds like a castrato. He tells me his voice is called tenor. How can I test if my son is gay?
Put on a Barbara Streisand movie.
Does it say what part of the country?
If he likes it, he's gay.
Does it say what part of the country this question comes from?
No, but his name's Gary.
Yeah, he's gay.
Like, that means that.
I know. Yeah. He's probably from the South, yes.
Yeah, Gary's gay. Sorry, buddy.
But Gary knows a lot about stereotypes of gay.
Well, I mean, narrow shoulders. You know, I think the dead giveaway is the blue eyes. I mean,
take it easy.
I think what you do is you get some garlic or you get a cross or you get some garlic or you put them in sunlight.
I heard.
And if any of that burns him or he's gay or a vampire.
I heard one time that if your son's gay, you hold him by his like Achilles tendon, you dip him in milk, and then when he comes out, he's just normal again. Or maybe that was a Greek mythology. I don't remember.
That could be. Spray some Windex on your son and ungay him.
Brad Pitt's coming to mind right now, but I'm not sure why.
Whoa! He's getting hot flashes
You guys aren't getting this at all, are you? I gave it away to you. Achilles. He paid Achilles in the movie
Troy.
Oh,
Troy. Yeah, I got it. Okay. I got it.
Jesus. What am I with a bunch of amateurs over here?
Well, if it was funny, you would have gotten the response you
wanted. Right.
Lee's list is getting
this
longer.
This is from Bart.
By the way, do yourself a favor. Stop at Goodwill and pick up some new Ratty t-shirts. I'm sick of the ones that you wear.
Oh, God.
I've seen you wear that wide-eye t-shirt like 14 times in the last 10 days.
I love this shirt.
I've never even seen this
14
shirt.
Times in 10 days.
He's seen me take it off a few times and put it back on. Mikey counts that as twice.
God bless Kosovo.
Kosovo.
Kosovo, if you're still
we love you. The Kosovars listening, we love
you. Kosovar,
that's what they are, Kosovars.
All right, next question.
I caught my son having sex with a guy, and I think he might be gay. Is there a definitive way I can tell?
He had sex with a guy, you moron. Next question.
Well, you know...
The waters have been tested. It's too late. Exactly, Mike.
There could be a little bit more investigation into that. But, I mean, I guess curiosity comes into play. But then it really can. Then it breaks down to, okay, when you caught these people having sex, what was your son doing at the time of sex? That kind of, you know, then you can...
Was he pitching or catching?
Yeah, well, that has a lot to do with it. But anyway... If you come home and your son's repeatedly stabbing his girlfriend, you sure that he's not? Did he murder his girlfriend? I mean, probably.
Let me ask you this. This is a question that's not sexual, but it's funny.
From this next time we do this segment, I want Eugene Levy on the show.
Or Fred Willard.
I want them both.
No, Rod Zimmerman, you're right.
How do you make just one word on MySpace all caps? Now, let's dissect this. MySpace, first of all. People are still using it.
So,
and how do you make it all caps? The shift key?
I feel like this may actually be an old person.
Her name is Lonnie Lou, so Asian. Lonnie Lou.
An Asian that doesn't know how to do
L-A-N-I-L-U.
Maybe on the Asian keyboard, the caps lock button didn't translate, so they don't have one.
I have to look into that, about the Asian keyboard.
Is a gay character more likely to die in a gay-directed or straight-directed film?
Anyway, next question.
There's some stupid ones out here. I was bitten by a turtle when I was a young lad. Should I still drink orange juice?
Whoa, is it Sunny D or is it orange juice from concentrate?
I don't even know. What the? I thought you were about to say. I thought you were about to say something like, "I got bit by a ninja turtle when I was young, and I wanted like I've been jumping around like a ninja lately or something." I don't know.
Does he have like superpowers or something?
You know, did the Asians come up with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Were they the ones that did, or was that American?
I think it was it. It was Japan.
Japan.
Yeah, it's Japanese.
Only the Japanese would take something like a turtle that's slow and useless and turn it into like this like awesome fighting machine.
How many gays does it take to make a gay sandwich?
I'm
going with three. But it depends. I mean, does this sandwich have meat, lettuce, tomato, mayonnaise, and bread?
No, it's all meat. Ask Gary from the last question.
All right.
I will tell you, this one's funny. This one's kind of funny, and I'm going to get in trouble for admitting this is funny, but it's funny. What minorities will gay people pick on once they're accepted within society?
Oh, man.
I think they're just going to pretty much accept. They're going to just jump in with everybody here.
I got to say, that's pretty funny. We'll do one more, then we'll do another thing.
I want to throw this out here. I have a friend of mine that I work with who's gay. Great guy.
Yeah.
Not a flaming gay, more like a camper gay, but he's gay. And
more like a camper gay?
Well, you know how like gays like to go hiking and camping, and they do gay shit in the woods and inside their tent and stuff.
You know, he's a nature gay.
Yeah, there's lots of nature gays.
Yeah.
Anyway, my point is he told me that he's been to three Mini Cooper stores. And apparently when you're gay, you can spot other gay people. Like,
it's called gaydar.
Yeah, but gay people have some serious gaydar, okay? A lot of times, well, anyway, let's not get sidetracked. Point is that he was telling me at the three Mini Cooper dealerships that he was at around Chicago, he said over 70% of the staff were gay men.
Really?
Yeah, and they have trail mix vending machines. Organic trail mix vending machines.
Don't go to the other side, Mikey. Don't go to the other side.
Over trail mix?
He thinks you're so fat, you would turn gay for trail mix.
I did not.
I don't even really like trail mix.
It's not that great. I'm not a huge fan of trail mix.
Oh, you know what?
I
like not trail mix. It's granola. I do like granola.
Like that. Girardos or whatever. The Girardos.
I know what you're talking about.
Ghirardelli?
No, the ones that come in the package at the gas station. No, not Jardiniere.
You always eat the black ones first.
No, the black ones.
Yeah, the black.
You're talking about. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, with the chips. It's like a different.
Mix.
It's like
not a trail mix.
It's a mix.
No,
they got mix.
No, you're talking about Gardettos.
Gardettos, and they got a mix.
No,
they got a mix.
That's not trail mix.
I'm not saying it's trail mix. It's a better mix.
It's a better mix.
It's an Italian trail mix.
No, it's not even trail mix.
It's an Italian trail mix.
Raisins and M&Ms. I hate trail mix.
Yeah,
well, it's an Italian trail mix.
No, actually, you know what's great about that? You can buy like the little rye pieces
by
themselves.
The black ones, those are the best. That's what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. Those are great. Fantastic.
This was written by someone in the column Civic Participation. How do I go about instituting white slavery in America? No?
Well, that might take a lot of jobs away from some Mexicans. there's a whole sect of this country that's being supported in certain ways like that, and I think that would be a bad political move. I mean, I think it would be terrible.
Yeah, I think making white people slaves is a terrible move. Terrible move.
This comes back to my original statement
earlier.
I'm
too small to be a
slave. Why
did
they have to be white slaves? Why can't we just all be slaves? Everybody should just be equal.
We are all slaves,
you know?
Anyway,
I mean,
in a way.
Yeah.
We're all slaves to the corporations, to the big boys.
I am a slave that has been straddled, and I have a leash and everything when it comes to food. I love food.
I like this one from Ken. What causes masturbation and sexual addictions in a guy? Masturbation and sexual addictions are such addictions which are said to be more powerful than drug and cigarette addictions.
I mean, I know some guys that have some sexual addictions.
Do you believe in it, though? Sexual addiction?
I do, because I there's a guy I work with who tells me he can't stop thinking about sex all day long. Like, he told me when he was, like, in high school, he would, like, literally go beat off like 4 or 5 times a day in the bathrooms.
This is my favorite. This is for your friend. How can a person avoid frequently masturbation and pornography? How do you avoid it? How do you avoid it? I don't know. Not do it?
Yeah, you don't avoid it.
Yeah. Have a girlfriend that likes to screw.
Get a girlfriend who likes to screw. Oh, I love when they... Okay. Oh, Megan's a horn dog. She'll love this one. My penis slipped out of my Speedo. I'm on my school swim team, and as I was getting ready to dive, I realized my junks were hanging out on top of the diving board. Every girl on the team saw my dick. I'm not shaved, so it was hairy. Then I ran to the locker room and started to dress up. My crush was there, too. What the freak do I do?
Well, it depends really how big his penis is.
Well, no, usually those diving...
And his name's Spanish Dude.
All right.
I'm not going to get into stereotypes here, but...
What the fuck does that have to do with anything?
Hey, I'm just saying.
I'm pretty sure.
What,
Spanish
every minority
dudes,
apparently has a big penis.
Not Spanish dudes. I think they got small ones. I thought
freshman.
Isn't
year,
that how it works?
I don't know.
Freshman year, I was on the.
Oh,
dive
they
team.
Do. Well, that doesn't mean they have big ones.
Look,
they have
look.
10
time
kids.
Out. Time out. Time out. Time out. All I'm saying is, if he's rocking with some fucking, you know, if he's got a good.
It doesn't sound like it. He seems to be freaking out.
If he's got a kielbasa down there, next time he sees those ladies, she just point at him and be like, you know.
Okay, well, let's
you know.
Say you're in his position. Exactly. No one said anything to you. Is that a good sign or a bad sign?
I would just let it go.
That everyone acted like it didn't happen.
Who cares? You know what? Now you got. I showed you what I'm working with, all right? You got a problem with that?
Rocking with your
cock out. You want to touch it? You
now,
touch
wait.
It?
They may not be talking to you, though, because you were on the diving board, and it's so small no one saw.
Okay.
It's
so,
a distance,
so
that
cares?
Diving board.
It's over. It happens.
So he should just move on.
Move on.
Yeah.
Move on.
This guy seems
but what like... does he do about his freak? I mean, his crush.
So what do you mean?
He had a crush that saw it. His crush saw it.
She doesn't care.
Well, he's now one step closer to that crush being a reality.
Well,
have you ever noticed that every girl a guy has a crush on is a girl he's not dating?
Yes. And never dates, by the way.
Right. I think a lot of the times dating your like big crush in high school would be like meeting your hero, that whole thing where you'd realize you're like, oh, my God, this is not that great.
Yeah. then when you get, you're like, next.
Here's a good one. Don't judge me when I ask this. That's what he said. N. His name's N.
N?
What's the best way to masturbate? Because I want to do something new. Any ideas? And don't say get a girlfriend.
The dead fish.
Obviously, everyone told him, why don't you get a girlfriend? And he's like, stop it.
Mike, the dead fish.
What's the dead fish? Let the master speak. What's the dead fish?
You sit on your hand.
You've done that before?
No, I've heard of you.
What happens when you sit
I've
on
heard
your
about
hand?
This too, and it's,
yeah.
Damn it! If
oh, I thought it's called the stranger.
What, yeah,
stranger,
that's exactly
yeah,
what I know.
Stranger,
if your hand
fish.
Goes numb because there's no blood in it, you can't move it either.
Why would yours be the dead fish? Do you like
no,
pretend
that's,
a fish is like
no,
sucking you off?
Does this come back to like him dead fishing girls back?
dead horsing.
Yeah, the stranger. I don't know. Try the stranger. Yeah. Try that out.
What about all these masturbation questions, by the way?
They're popular on here.
What the hell's going on here?
Here's one that's not a masturbation question. Do you think that I will grow any taller? So I turned 16 in June, and I'm 6'3". At the beginning of the summer, I was 6'2". Then I was 6'2 and a half a couple weeks ago. Now I'm 6'3". I think I will definitely grow a little more, but how much more do you think? By the way, my dad is only 5'10", and my mom's 5'7". And I'm the tallest person in my family. I play a lot of sports and lift weights. But why do you think I'm so tall and I'm only 16? Captain America posted that.
You know what? I think on this question, we're going to end this segment.
Well, it's
been a great segment, but we've... We've.
This is a good question. Do you think he'll grow any taller?
No, we've outlived this.
All right, I have to pick a good one to end on. A good one.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, he'll
this
grow
one's
taller,
good. This one's good. Do you like this one, Adam?
The worst use one was horrible.
Is this one good? From Carter, when will I start being able to produce semen? I would also like to know about stuff we learn in health class. I've really not been paying attention. By the way, I'm 13.
Usually by 13, you can.
Man, I've started to learn, though, the sex questions on here are a lot of parents that are worried about their kids and a lot of kids really curious about dirty shit.
Yeah, but you
know
what?
13. He's a teenager.
And
dude. Certain,
you know what? You know what I think would be more interesting is the responses that some of these questions have gotten.
Well, that was your part that you were supposed to
do. That
was
a horrible question to end on.
That was a good one. When are you going to start producing
the best,
semen?
The best one, I think one of the best so far.
Orange juice?
It's got to be. I got bit by a turtle when I was a kid. Can I stop drinking orange juice?
Look, I'm doing this on the fly. I didn't plan all of them out.
No, it was good. I think we had some great laughs. We just
hold on.
It was three. It was that segment was three questions too
hold
long.
Hold on. Faye Lynn's penis stolen by thieves. Faye Lynn, 41, of the Niquio village near Wenling City, is East China's Zhejiang province, told police he was asleep when the thieves burst into his room, put a bag over his head. They put something over my head and pulled down my trousers, and then they ran off. I was so shocked, I didn't feel a thing. Then I saw I was bleeding and my penis was gone. Police believed the attackers were jealous lovers of several local women whom Lynn was having affairs with. Lynn denied taking part in any infidelity. Emergency workers and police searched for Lynn's anatomy, but turned up nothing, according to TNT Magazine. The penis thieves are nowhere to be found, but police said they're looking for the jealous lovers.
Well, apparently when you're fucking ninjas... you shouldn't be cheating on them because you're gonna have to miss
you got some ninja friends.
Could you now wait? If they don't find his penis, he just doesn't have. Could you? I'd kill myself not having a penis the rest of your life. You'd kill yourself, right?
Well, here's the problem. Here would be the problem. If they cut off his entire penis. Any sensory
gone.
Anything is gone.
Right. So why would you want to live?
Well, you know, this comes back to like my buddy. My buddy who works really hard. He goes to the gym all the time, and he goes, you know, it wasn't for me trying to get my squad and everything all the time. He goes, I think I just sit at home.
Squad is penis for the listeners.
Thanks, Alex.
You're welcome.
But no, I mean, I don't know. Because you would have, like, the urge to have sex, and then there would just be nothing there.
Would you really want to live
and
without
a
penis?
You couldn't touch anything that makes it feel, you know,
we'd
be gone.
I'd kill myself.
I couldn't do it. Don't kill yourself. Peeing would be interesting.
I'd steal somebody else's.
Yeah, how do you pee without a penis?
Actually, you know, Alex, you bring up a solid point. There's some people that die every day. So if they can reattach your own penis, can't they just cut one off a dead guy and reattach him?
All right, that's
a good question.
Lee, write that down.
Put it on Yahoo Answers.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Mike just had the best Yahoo answer that I need.
I'm serious, though. If they can
Does anyone know anything about this? Can you get a dick transplant, and does it work?
Oh, yeah, transgender.
Yeah, but do they get hard?
Fuck, I don't know.
Look, all I'm saying is if that works...
No.
Well, here's the thing, but if it's the same blood type, if you take away the rejection...
now we're comparing blood...
If you take away the possibility of rejection, and just look at the pure mechanics of it, if somebody cuts your penis off and runs off with it, if they can take that penis and sew it back on, why didn't they take another penis and sew it back on and have it work?
No, I get that. I think you can do that, but can you actually get it hard and get off? I don't think so.
Take a lot of Viagra.
You know what? You might be. Well, what about John Bobbitt?
That's true.
He got it reattached.
He got it reattached,
and he came out with a porn called Frankendick or something.
True.
Interesting. He came out with a porn?
Yeah, it was called like Frankendick.
It was called like Frankendick. That is true. But wouldn't the organ die at some point? Like, isn't this Chinese man's penis? Like, they couldn't even reattach it if they got
it. I would imagine you'd probably have
you have put that in ice real quick.
I think it'd be like a couple days.
Real quick.
Yeah, but they found John Bobbitt's penis was like out the window or something, wasn't it?
It's true.
Oh my God, there's a flying dick.
I love how Matthew Lillard and I were talking about how awesome the 90s were, and now we're talking about John Bobbitt. This is perfect.
90s are back,
dude.
Baby.
But the 90s were great.
You were playing video games. A Las Vegas man is in jail for attempted murder, and his weapon of choice was a toilet lid. Police said Ronald Hetzel, 41, allegedly broke into a neighbor's home on Saturday morning by opening a window and then struck the owner over the head with a wooden guitar and a porcelain toilet bowl lid during a confrontation. The encounter began after police responded to a complaint about a man throwing objects in his own house. When they arrived on the scene, they saw a man later identified as Hetzel sitting on the curb, shirtless and screaming. Yeah, this is why Cops always happens in Nevada and Florida, by the way. That's when and then officers said they tried successfully to calm down Hetzel. He jumped a back fence into the neighbor's yard, broke through a window, and entered the home. A male resident inside that home told the station that Hetzel started fighting with him, bashing him in the head with a wood guitar and a toilet lid, and trying to strangle him. During the attack, Hetzel also allegedly tried to strangle the homeowner multiple times, leaving him with many bruises. Toilet lid. That's an interesting way.
Yeah, it is.
How do you kill someone with a toilet lid?
Oh, he killed
him.
Did
he kill them?
Well, no, but nah, that's what I'm saying. How do you?
How about Lenny hitting?
You'd have to keep hitting them. Yeah, that's pretty shitty. That's good.
Dude, back in the day at a bar, Lenny hit some guy with a server tray.
But yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I love Lenny. He's a great guy. But that's like talking to fucking 85 Bears winning the World Series. Can you come up with something else? Is there something new that's happened recently?
What?
That'd be like...
Is he talking about the mid?
That'd be like 50 years from now. It'd be like, Len's a tough guy. You remember that one time 45 years ago when he hit that guy with the server tray when he wasn't looking?
Yeah, when he wasn't looking with the server tray.
Right.
We're talking about that incident of the spread?
Like Jesus.
I was just comparing.
What we should be talking about, at least something newer than that, which was more impressive, is when we started with those guys on the sidewalk when they couldn't get in the van.
Oh, yeah.
And Len slapped that guy. You know, I mean, and we were all ready to go. I was hoping those little fucks were going to do something. But, you know, they kind of pushed out and they ran away, but which is fine. I mean, we were much bigger than they were.
You guys scare me.
But you know what I'm saying?
No,
that right there, that'd be a better thing to talk about. Anyway, my whole point, what I was getting at, Matt, and if you agree here, is that I think we're going quite a ways into overtime.
Well, this is the last one because this one is for Leonard Cannata. Baldness meds turn man into woman. Claims generic baldness drug turned her into a woman. A 38-year-old former software engineer says that taking medication for baldness transformed him from a man into a woman. Mandy McKee, formerly known as William McKee, began taking a generic version of Propecia, which Leonard takes, in October 2008 to combat male pattern baldness.
I've taken a year's worth of generic Propecia.
At that time, McKee was a married man and was energetic, focused, sharp, and athletic. McKee took the medication for 9 months, during the time which she says she developed an array of side effects. She says her mental alertness severely decreased and she lost work as a result. Even more alarming, however, were the physical changes. On her website, McKee writes that her rock-hard chest softened and began to turn into breasts. Her shoulders were literally falling into a more feminine position, and her hips were loosening and becoming wider as on a woman's body. What's more, the pill barely did anything to treat his baldness. You don't think so? Or you think it could have been a tranny?
Hold on, let me see this.
Okay. Mikey needs to see video proof here so we can talk about this. Are we calling bullshit? I don't know. It's kind of manly here, the upper forehead. Tranny? Do we think... So we're thinking this person's trying to get maybe some publicity by claiming it was some drug or sue.
Right.
She's trying to sue someone.
I'm just going to throw this out here. I've taken a year and 2 months worth of Propecia.
Mm-hmm.
Propecia is a smaller dose of a prostate medication called finasteride. They found it was a side effect of because what they found is the dihydrotestosterone, which is a byproduct of testosterone that occurs in the male body, causes your prostate to grow and also causes your chest hair to grow, your back hair to grow, and your hair to fall off. And when they discovered finasteride to try to help treat enlarged prostates, a byproduct of it is a prohibited hair loss because of the block to conversion of DHT. There's also some estrogen receptor. There's some pills for after you take steroids that are supposed to help boost everything to do a similar effect, but not quite as good as Propecia. Long story short, there's been some stories and side effects of erectile dysfunction, but all those side effects, all the loss of sex drive and everything from taking this immediately goes away as soon as you stop taking it. So I think this story is absolutely 100% bullshit.
Okay, well, that may be bullshit, but something you brought up leads me to this. Propecia, baldness drug linked with sexual problems even after men stopped taking it. Is this true? There was a study where a bunch of people – I can't get to it right now. I don't know why.
Have 1%. or some small portion that...
The researchers found that 89%. The study included 54 men who experienced sexual problems at least 3 months after stopping Propecia. The researchers found that 89% of them still had sexual problems severe enough to be considered to have sexual dysfunction. Time reported that for 96% of the men who took Propecia and then stopped, sexual side effects continued on more than a year later. So that's 4%.
Yeah, but how many of them had erectile function problems before they started taking Propecia?
That's a good question. Exactly. They could be lying. Exactly. They may not be. But they may not be.
Well, you know,
exactly.
I think a lot of that has to do with the amount of testosterone. If they're older men and they have a lower amount of testosterone in their body as it is, then maybe it has a bigger effect on them. Because obviously me and Kanata don't have any issues.
Well, we're not sure about Lenny. He talks to strippers for 3 hours at strip clubs. That's an issue. That's a dysfunction,
under
if you ask me.
Under the bus, take it easy.
That's a dysfunction, if you ask me.
Yeah, sausage and meatballs.
Come on, 3 hours? How do you not get a wood in that 3 hours and go, hey, I got a $120, which you know he has, and he throws around like nothing, and go to a back room? Come on.
I don't know, you can do that with girls in Vegas.
Oh, Mikey, you do it with girls in Chicago. What are you talking about? Allegedly.
No, I've never done it.
Never?
No.
You didn't know you could do that with girls in Vegas. Come on.
No, I didn't know you could do that with strippers in Vegas.
Well, you shouldn't. It's against the law.
My point is that go hit up the lagoon at the Mirage or something and go pick up a professional girl, not some slutty stripper.
But Lenny was in love with the slutty stripper, so that doesn't count as an
argument. Yeah, and we
called
her and talked to her on the radio show, and she talked about sausage and meatballs and bringing water in and opening up a bakery. I mean, I don't know what Lenny was drinking, but look, I think it's time to end the show.
He was drinking Propecia because he couldn't get it up. Okay, we're going to leave it at that. And Mikey, Alex, thank you.
Hey, real quick.
Adam on the sound.
Hold on.
Adam on the sound.
Can we go get some food?
I knew that's why you wanted to stop the show. I knew it. I could smell your hunger from across the table.
I know you're hungry.
And I sensed he wanted to stop the show to go get food like 30 minutes ago.
You're not supposed to eat after 10.
Am I right?
You're right.
Am I right? I sensed it with you. I knew it.
But we are getting a little long-winded here.
I know. This is actually going to be a three-hour show.
I know.
But that's because we did no talking during the first 2 hours.
Sorry, Mike. Mike's.
So where can we go eat?
The only thing open is like White Castle.
White Castle.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
Not bullshit.
Well, Omega's closed.
I'm not eating LBT.
Shit.
I won't eat LBT. It's awful.
What's LBT?
Los Burritos Tepitos. Awful. Terrible.
Worst.
Terrible.
I hate it. No, I hate all
Megan
this.
Probably thinks
I hate
it's
all this.
The highest ranked Mexican
that's
cuisine.
That's all greasy shit on a shingle.
She
bad
loves
name
that
Mexican
shit, though.
Food.
She loves it, right?
Taco Express.
Taco Express.
From the Matthew Aaron Show.
Wait, we got to decide on where we're eating. Where are we eating? It's 11 o'clock. Where's it going
to
be open?
I need to charge my phone, and I need to do some research.
You're going to Yelp.
He's getting cranky.
I'm not Yelp.
Now.
Why do you got to Yelp?
He's getting cranky.
I research.
No, you don't research. You
Yelp.
Yelp
happens to be one of 5 tools that I use to research.
Give us the other 4 before we go.
Let me ask you a question, man.
He's getting pissed. He's going
to
hit.
How many tools do you have on your phone to find?
Zero. Zero. I just walked into places.
Last time I was on your phone, I actually...
I have a nose.
I think I remember I spent about an hour playing with about 14 different apps on your phone to find out.
I have no idea what you speak of. I have a nose for good food. I just use my nose.
Anyway.
See?
Point being.
Okay, we're going to go. Mikey's getting hungry.
Good night.
Good night.
Hey.
And thank you to Allison Burnett and Matthew Lillard.
Absolutely. Great. And from everybody here at the Matthew and Aaron Show, out to Kosovo, we thank you. Mm-hmm. We love your support. And America, you guys is our home. So, by the way, we do like apple pie. If anybody's had apple pie in Kosovo, let us know.
And anyone from Kosovo that wants to come.
I should set up
Chicago.
A P.O. box so they could send us some Kosovo food.
No, that's okay.
I got a P.O. box we could send it to.
It's a P.O. box.
No, the apple pie would go bad. That's okay. Yeah. Anyway, so we wouldn't have time to get to the P.O. box. But great thought, though. Great thought. We'll find another place to put fan mail where somebody attends it. So anyway, great show, guys. Love you, Kosovo.
I'm waiting on you to stop talking.